Call the meeting to order. We have four bills today, and we're going to move through them as much as we can. Make sure everybody gets a fair hearing, and several of them are going to be moved for inclusion in the omnibus bill, and I believe we have one that isn't. So let's start first with Representative Peterson. Welcome to the Committee on Housing and Public Health.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is House File 250, dealing with ambulances and transferring of some money for education and completion of courses, dealing with inter-facility transfers, and dealing specifically with labor concerns and qualified people in rural areas of the state. With me today is Mary Hedges and Buck McAlpin, who can walk us through quickly and go from
there. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Let's get your bill moved, and where does it need to go? This one is for inclusion in our bill, or are you moving this on to another committee?
I think this is...
Or to the floor.
I think this is it. It doesn't actually spend any new money. It got referred here because it transfers money. And the motion out of Representative Peterson's committee was to Mr. Carlson's committee and then to you, and I'm not aware of that it needs to go back to Lynn Carlson or not.
The last place that it was is where it needs to go. Was that Representative Carlson?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It'll go back to finance. So we need a motion.
I'll move that. House File 250.
Representative McFarland moves House File 250 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if we could just... We'll go quickly here. Thank you.
Fine, that's fine.
Go ahead.
That's fine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hedges, and I'm the Executive Director of the state's lead EMS agency, Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. We're the state agency that licenses all the ambulance services in the state, as well as the EMS personnel who work on the ambulance.
Talking a little bit.
Yeah. We're the state agency that licenses all the EMS personnel in the state, as well as ambulance services. And we also do a variety of grant programs to support what is still primarily a volunteer EMS system in rural Minnesota. This bill has three parts, and it's all focused toward supporting our struggling rural ambulance services. And the only part that mentions money is the third part. Would you like me to speak to all three parts or just the third part?
Why don't you briefly summarize what the bill is so the committee knows?
Okay.
Just very briefly, it'll be fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first part, as Representative Peterson alluded to, is simply a provision to allow struggling rural volunteer ambulance services to request a variance to allow them to substitute one of the two EMTs that are currently required on each ambulance call with a first responder driver. And we currently have this provision through a temporary variance, but this would allow them to request a variance for a two-year period consistent to run with their ambulance licensure. So it's not a big change, just extending the length of the variance time. The second portion of the bill is similar in that it allows both, it addresses rural ambulance staffing shortages, and it says both, it would propose that both basic life support and advanced life support ambulances be allowed to substitute a first responder as the driver for the EMT on the call for long distance, for inter-facility transports. And this is oftentimes when a patient is at a hospital and needs in a rural community and needs to be taken to a larger city hospital. And oftentimes that drive, transferring that patient, can take easily 3 hours one way, so a total of a six-hour drive where you're tying up two ambulance personnel that are not available to respond to the other emergency or 911 calls. That would occur on the long-distance interfacility transport. The third part of the bill is a proposal to increase the amount set in statute that the board may reimburse volunteer ambulance services for training, initial training of the EMT and the two-year continuing ed training or refresher training that EMTs must go through. Currently under statute, and for the last 13 years, we are allowed to reimburse them $450 for the initial class, $225 for the refresher class, for the people on their service that they've paid for. That has not been increased for 13 years, and the average cost of initial EMT class has risen to approximately $1,000, and the refresher is closer to an average of $300. So we're asking that funding, that maximum reimbursement amount be increased to $600 for initial and $275 for the refresher or the continuing ed. And why this will not cost any more money is because the board is not asking for additional funds to do this. We currently budget $385,000 per year to reimburse this volunteer training. And pursuant to a session law passed about 4 years ago, any money left in that $385,000 is distributed equally to the 8 regional programs once a year. And we've talked with the regional programs, and they're in support of this, but they would rather see it go to reimburse a volunteer training fund than be distributed at the end of the year. So again, we would not spend any more than that $385,000 already budgeted. It would just allow us to reimburse more for the training.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Did you want to make a brief statement, sir?
Yes, Madam Chair, just quickly, for the record, Buck McKelton, President of the Ambulance Association. These three initiatives in this bill with the regulatory board are three the Minnesota Ambulance Association also brought forward to. We have quite a crisis in rural Minnesota with staffing, and working with the state EMS regulatory board, they addressed a lot of these issues, and we definitely support this bill from our association.
Thank you very much. Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment of support. Thank you, Representative Peters, for carrying this. And we've testified here before, the difficulty for Greater Minnesota Ambulance Services, EMTs, and emergency professionals in general to provide and train the staff necessary for the basic services we provide. This would just provide some flexibility. Oftentimes, that second EMT is not available. So how do we, in fact, find the resources to transport patients? So this, again, no backslide in patient care in any way. It just actually would allow us to be more flexible and effective. So.
Great. Any further discussion? If not, Representative McFarland renews her motion that House File 250 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion fails. Take it away, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. The next bill before us is House File 869. Representative Taylor. Welcome to the committee. And let's see, we need a motion to move House File 869. I believe it would be then made over for consideration in our omnibus bill. Is that correct?
I'll make that motion.
Mr. Kearns moves that House File 869 be recommended to pass and made over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill that we're bringing before you today, dealing with housing, with tribal housing, actually has components for both urban housing as well as the non-urban. And I have with me today Jane Barrett from Red Lake, who's been working very hard for the last 3 years on the tribal housing in Red Lake. I will leave most of the discussion to Jane. I would just like to add that, you know, in her testimony, she will be talking about the great needs that we have for housing in the Red Lake Reservation, or on the Red Lake Reservation, and the fact that the Red Lake Reservation is separate from in considerations from the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. I know that can often be confusing, so I just wanted to make sure that we're aware of that. But this bill is for appropriations for the next 2 years for the tribal housing to address the housing needs. And so I will turn it over now to Jane Barrett from Red Lake.
Thank Welcome, Ms. Barrett. If you could just introduce yourself for the tape, please.
My name is Jane Barrett. I am the Executive Director for the Red Lake Reservation Housing Programs. Good morning, Madam Chair and representatives. I'll keep my remarks basically regarding Red Lake and the needs on Red Lake, since we are a totally separate entity. I guess I'd like to begin with saying that today we have 440 families waiting for housing on the reservation. From this of this group, the of the 440, we have 360 of these families are families with children. Unlike other areas in Minnesota, Red Lake's population is increasing. We have a homeless shelter in Red Lake that was just opened in January of 2006. This past year, we were able to provide services for 210 individuals, which included also another 79 children. Most of our people within that came for services were Native people from Red Lake. Of these 210 individuals that were counted, these are people who were there, could have been there more than once, so we're not doing any of our figures. During the year, January 1 through December 31, 2007, the Housing Authority provided rental assistance and down payment assistance for 91 families, and that doesn't include any of the families that I had mentioned earlier, the 440. So we still have the 440 families waiting for housing, crowded into other units on the reservation. Since the inception of the Housing Finance Corporation, we have issued 551 loans, and we currently are still holding 516. The remaining have been paid off, and we also have 49 rental units. During the years 2005 and 2006, we made 65 loans for new construction, acquisition, and renovation at the cost of $3,760,000. The majority of the loans were for new construction and renovation because of the shortage of housing for acquisition on the reservation. The Finance Corporation is really the only institution on the reservation that allows for loans for renovations. This year we've committed $284,000 of the Finance Corporation dollars to a low-income housing tax credit project for 20 units, which is a major amount of leveraging of the dollars that we have. With our returned interest and principal from the loans that we have out, we have our administrative staff costs, our salaries, fringe insurance for the properties, accounting, legal fees, maintenance, rental subsidies, and we also do many, many emergency loans for furnace replacements, wells, and septic systems. And because of the high rate of diabetes on the reservation, it's not uncommon for families to need ramps and handicapping of bathrooms. And after all of those costs, we also try and do at least a couple more regular housing loans. As you all know, construction costs have increased greatly, but the incomes on the reservation have basically stayed the same. And with the population, where the majority population is shifting towards elders now, our population is shifting towards people from the age of 25 to 30, and this is the prime age for would normally be home ownership families and people with children. We've worked with the state of Minnesota partnership with the state of Minnesota, actually, and worked real well with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Our program has been very successful. Other states have tried to replicate our program with limited success, but with the commitment of the Housing Finance Agency, we've been able to do very well, not only with the Finance Corporation, but also using their low-income housing tax credit dollars. They've made it one of their a big point to provide assistance to the tribes. We have when I think about the housing shortage on the reservation, it really concerns me a lot, not only for the lack of housing, but the type of future that this overcrowded living puts on our children. You know, the children need to know every night, you know, that they're going to have a place to sleep, that they're going to have a place to study, that they're going to be living in a healthy environment. Children with housing are, it's been proven, are more likely to suffer from physical and emotional health issues and are likely to be not as successful in school. The basic needs for children begin with housing, and I respectfully request your consideration for the bill, and I can answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Barrett. Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sarah, the witness, how much of the, what you're requesting is also matched with federal dollars?
Ms. Barrett.
Madam Chair and Representative, these, depending upon the type of housing program activities, the dollars we'll be requesting are specifically for our state dollars, but we would be using other types of, applying for other types of dollars where we can. Like with the tax credit, we have applied and received tax credits for 20 units, and of that we're using $280,000 of the Finance Corporation dollars, but we were able to get slightly under $3 million using low-income housing tax credits for the units. So we do leverage the dollars as much as possible.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson,
you're saying that you're going to get $3 million more on top of this from the federal government?
This the tax credits are a federal program. It's through the IRS, in which corporations are able to take a tax, write off taxes by applying dollars to low-income housing.
Okay, Madam Chair. Representative Saylor, do you know what the proposed budget is for the tribes from the governor's standpoint, or from the targets? Do you know anything about as far as what is being proposed?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't have that figure, but possibly Tanya Orr, who's with the Minnesota Housing Finance, she might do by chance have that? Okay, no. So I don't have that figure at this point. One thing I would like to, yes.
Maybe our own staff, does our staff have something? Okay. Right. Go ahead. We'll see if we can find it here.
Right. I would like to mention that this is very much an ongoing project. In fact, Jane Barrett will be meeting tomorrow with Tanya Orr from the Minnesota Housing Finance to be working on, you know, how this all goes together. I also, you know, just wanted to say that Red Lake has done a tremendous job in the last 3 years. They had formerly had some budget reserve, and they have since Ms. Barrett joined and kind of took over that program, they have really increased dynamically the number of loans that have been put into place on Red Lake. And so they've really been using the money very, very well at Red Lake, trying to get the money on the ground out where it needs to be. rather than in a reserve somewhere. So they've done a very good job with that and will continue. And the fact that they're able to leverage some of the federal dollars, those federal tax credit dollars, has been very helpful as well to make the money go the furthest. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sayle, the way the language is written here, it doesn't specifically say what like, so it looks like for all Native American tribes throughout the state of Minnesota, and I'm just, you know, you're talking about the Red Lake Reservation, Red Lake people, but I know that they're going to get some of the money, but I don't know if they're going to get more than what a percentage is, how it's broken up on in the formula for the other Native American tribes throughout the state of Minnesota. So it's good that at least there's a representation of the tribes here.
Thank you. Representative Schumper. Oh, you know, excuse me. Representative Moe, I think his name.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It looks like we have...
And Representative Sayle, also, this question, a comment and then a question from Ms. Barrett, and it's partly in response to Representative Anderson's question. First off, in many of the tribes spend considerable resources also on housing, and I know Leech Lake, which I represent, and the Chippewa tribe both dedicate a considerable amount of resources to housing. The need is far, far in excess of what they could ever possibly accomplish with their financial resources available. And so giving them some tools to leverage additional state and federal dollars is a great investment for us. I guess I would like you to maybe respond to the personal the individual commitment the Red Lake Nation makes to housing. I mean, I know it's considerable, and I don't know what that is, but it pales in comparison to this small investment on the state's part, I think, right?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Moe, we have each year all of the income dollars that we take in, not only for the Finance Corporation, but for through the Housing Authority also, those are dollars that are put back into housing, into areas where, like, we can't match federal against federal programs. So we really take, we watch very closely where all of these dollars are and where they're going for, so we can use our dollars as much as possible in the ways that would be best, and so that can be matched properly. The tribe also does a lot of work, not only with the housing authorities, but you know, they extra dollars that they might have go into subsidizing for, like, our elderly nursing home, our senior housing, and a lot of the well, they'd be considered elderly single-family housing, too. The dollar figures I can't give you immediately, but that's number one on our list, basically.
One follow-up.
Representative Moe?
Statement and then question. Again, from Leech Lake, the last I saw their list of on the... their housing waiting list families was in the hundreds, 400 something, right. I think. And those are families that are, several families oftentimes are living in one and two bedroom homes in congested conditions that I don't think we could really fathom unless, like, Representative Sayle and I actually go and knock on their doors. It's quite remarkable. But it's a testament to commitment to family, one, but two, of the great need. And maybe you could comment on Red Lake, what the pent-up need currently is for housing.
Well, like I said earlier, we have a waiting list of 440 families. When the office of the HUD Office of Native American Programs listed Red Lake as one of the most overcrowded reservations within the Eastern Woodlands area. So, you know, that shows that we, you know, this includes the tribes all across the Great Lakes and then all the way from Maine down to Florida. So it's a major problem.
Thank you, Ms. Barrett. Looks like Ms. Orr is there. Do you have something to add to the earlier question?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I was just going to respond to your question about what portion of the money under the statute, the Tribal Indian Housing Program, Red Lake gets 30% of the state appropriation. The Minnesota Chippewa Tribe is allocated 60%, or court, I'm sorry, 70%. My math is really bad today. And then the Sioux communities get a negligible amount, like $160,000 in the past or something like that. So it's the split is basically 30% for Red Lake and 70% for the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Orr, if you would stay up there, please. Thank you. I think what I'm seeing this bill is that these are dedicated fundings that are going into a separate agency, and maybe Representative Saylor can speak to that, but I wanted to get some input. If that's the case, I wanted to get some input from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, how they would view that, because I think there's an issue of control here and how is the money distributed, and based on what she has just told us, 30% goes to one tribes, and there's a current distribution of 60 and then 10, how that would all interface. So I guess to Representative Saylor, is the intent of this bill to set up a separate agency so that these are appropriated and going directly to the individual tribes that are represented here, or how is that working?
Representative Saylor.
Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson, no, the intent is not to set up separate, but rather because they are all dealt with together. We're simply bringing forth the need at Red Lake, highlighting that in particular, because that is the tribe that I represent. But it's not the intent of this bill to separate it out. I will further say that there are ongoing talks. In fact, tomorrow, as I referenced earlier, there is a meeting that Jane Barrett will be having with Tanya Orr regarding, just how this is going to move forward. So there is a certain extent, of a work in progress with this, but it's not the intent to separate out Red Lake from the Chippewa Tribe.
Madam Chair, so then this would go through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. Is that the current intent?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Okay.
Maybe just for information, if you look at references the statutes there, those are existing programs. This is not a new program.
Okay, I think Representative is...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to just go back and reference some comments that the testifier made early on. You said there's roughly 516 loans. How much? What's the value of the loans that you have out on the books right now?
Ooh. I can't give you that information right off the top of my head. I don't know.
Okay,
we're looking at probably, I'd say about, if you're considering the renovations and the home loans, probably about $50,000 per loan.
Okay, so we'd be 50 times 516. And then are most of them like 30-year fixed?
Yes.
Loan, and what's the interest rate that the loans are going out at?
5%.
5%?
Representative Eastland, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I have a follow-up. The last paragraph of your printed testimony on the first page, and I just had a question that I guess it's always been my understanding that these kinds of loans are, or these kinds of funds are kind of revolving loan funds. Mm-hmm. And I just, the comment that you made here caught interest, and I'd like some clarification. It says the return interest and principal of all of our loans is used for salaries and fringe benefits and insurance and other operating expenses. And I guess my question is that the case? Are we consuming principal for operating expenses here, or is that a misprint or a misrepresentation of what's actually happening?
What it's
It's basically the operations is interest. The principal is turned, we fold that back into other loans. But the interest is used for operations, insurance, accounting fees, the rental subsidies, and so forth.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Easton. Just one last question. I don't think it's uncommon when we're involving state funds and state grants to get some kind of an accounting of how of what that looks like in terms of kind of a business operation that's going on. I mean, I understand there's some unique differences between what happens in other housing subsidy plans, but and what happens on the reservation, because I understand the. Is normal financing not available? Is that
that's right.
Is that the case?
Yeah.
And that's because of the land, the inability to encumber land.
Yes.
So I understand there's some differences, but I guess my final question, Madam Chair, would be.
I'm having a hard time keeping up with you, Representative, but down a little bit.
Huh?
Instead of having a hard time keeping up with you, just slow down a little bit here.
Okay. Well, my final question is it why couldn't this program be handled through the more traditional housing assistance programs that we offer? I mean, why couldn't assistance to the tribes be handled in a more traditional way rather than through a grant that basically just leaves and we have no control or authority to deal with at a future time?
Madam Chair, Representative, I got the... Ms. Orr just gave me the figures on what we have spent the last year. We have, if you look earlier on our the listing there, it shows that also that we've done, we do major amounts of loans out of there. We've done in the last year, 2 years, 65 loans out of that. And that comes out of also the interest and the principal coming passing through. So yes, we do, we have done major amounts of loans with that interest and principal as it comes through, as well as operate our program. And we do have a reporting system in place with the state MHFA for how the dollars are earned each year. We report as what our principal income is, what our interest income is, what we spent on insurance, taxes, because we do some off-reservation, and then what our total amount that's left over that we turn back into the revolving loan account.
Okay, Madam Chair, maybe just before the testimony is done on the bill, maybe it would be interesting to have the, if somebody's here from MHFA, maybe they could comment on the bill for us and just give us their take.
All right. Well, if that's Ms. Orr to come forward, I do have a question for you as well. And then we're going to move on, members. We got three more bills in session, so let's try to be succinct. Welcome to the committee. If you just introduce yourself, please, for the tape.
I'm Tanya Orr from the Finance Agency. Representative Eastland, the agency we've been operating the Tribal Indian Program for close to 30 years, or a little over 30 years. We do receive audited financials from each of the entities that fund it every year. So we do have a good understanding of how the money is used every year. The money is, the program was set up so that the program would be self-sustaining, so that payments on the loans would be used to administer the program and then be used to end. The remaining funds would be recycled into new loans. And Red Lake has the ability, has made loans so that repayments average around between $600,000 and $700,000 every year at their current level, so that they can recycle into new loans, which they do.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, here's my question. On the bill, the last half of the second to the last sentence on 115 and 116, what I'm reading is, the agency must not reduce or transfer these appropriations. Is that
typical? I mean, because that does throw it into a permanent grant, and it would therefore restrict MFHA to this. Explain that to me, because I have trouble with that restriction, I think. Somebody
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, just briefly, the reason that that's in there has to do with a little bit of the history of some of these monies being moved around and not available necessarily, in particular for Red Lake. And when in 2003, when the budget cuts, you know, were really doing a number on many of these programs, there was some consolidation that caused some problems, and that is what this bill is attempting to address, is saying that we can't, for instance, you know, move it all into urban or all into rural, but rather to keep a balance going. And this is really attempting to address some of the problems that arose after the 2003 budget cuts.
Madam Chair, I think I can understand that, but if the projects aren't ready to go, if they aren't designed and ready to go in the ground, then this money is just going to hang there and not be expended.
Representative Clark.
Representative Saylor.
I guess theoretically that could happen, but that's not the situation that's going on currently with Red Lake anyway. That's not at all the intent. The intent is to keep these loans moving and to build them up to the point where they kind of become their own endowment fund, so that there's continually enough money in that fund to do the housing rehabilitation and the new starts that are needed. But often what happens is, without some assurance, you know, if it were not guaranteed, without that assurance, they wouldn't really be able to plan their programs in advance, because it would possibly be dependent upon the legislature every couple of years. And so that has been a problem in the past, and that's what they're trying to address here.
Would MFHA concur?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, clearly I think the intent of this language in Subdivision 3 is to restrict the agency's ability to transfer money. We have actually standing authority to move money between programs, between loan programs to loan programs, grant programs to grant programs. To the best of my knowledge, we have never moved in money that's appropriated for Indian programs into any other program. However, the last biennium, the funding for the Indian programs was consolidated into the Challenge program. I think that probably the most important part of the Subdivision 3 is the fact that it's the statement that it's intended to be added for the permanent base, which at this point is not, because there was no funding for it in the last biennium, so the base budget is based on the last biennium, and so there's no base for those programs at this point.
So this is okay, just grant-type language.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, we did not include funding restoration of the base in the recommended budget. We recommended that the program consolidation that occurred 2 years ago be continued, and that funding be accessed through the Challenge program.
I'm reading the body language that goes up and down. So it's that's a yes.
Representative Peterson, I think it's safe to say, Ms. Orr, that the legislature decides, you know, the budget where it goes, and the agency several years ago recommended kind of mushing things together as maybe one thing, you know, incorporating it in the Challenge grant. And what we have here is taking it back out and making sure that they designated program of the agency, which was testified, was there for 30 years. I have a question I want to ask, which is, in terms of the urban Indian housing, I think there's a slight increase here, maybe $7,000, is that right, over the biennium? What is the increase for the tribal Indian housing program in this, if there is an increase?
Madam Chair, to the best of my recollection, these two, the amounts appropriated in this bill are the amounts that were appropriated to these two programs prior to budget cuts.
Okay. So I see. I understand. There's no increase beyond that then. Okay. And then this ratio of urban to tribal is about the same, is the same as it has been?
That's correct.
Okay. Let's see. Thank you. Representative Stevenson and Moe, and then we are going to vote because we need to...
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to get numbers on what the past budget has... I guess I want to see, is this additional onto the base? And I guess that clarified a little bit of the question when it's talking about the challenge grants that are out there that actually qualify for this particular. And I know the governor's bumped up a one-time funding in that to $15 million on this particular biennium. But I'm curious as to, are these then numbers in the intent of this bill then to go onto the base? Is that the intent, Representative Saylor?
Representative
Saylor. Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, yes.
So what would, Madam Chair, what would that number be with this inclusion?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, what would be the base for the agency with this $3 million? Depends upon what other actions you take. We have a base coming into this biennium of about $78 million. The recommendation is for about another $14 million in base money. So this would be another $3.3 million on top of that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I think we had a Representative Stevens, the Mo, excuse me.
Madam Chair, I'll make this brief. Just a couple of comments, too. As we've said, this is the population in Minnesota that has the most dramatic housing need. And so earmarking or specifically designating money for this purpose in particular, obviously, I think is in our best interest, one. And two, having it separate is also important because we do have an exceptional situation where we have essentially citizens that have dual citizenship. And it does take special expertise for us to serve them, and we need to do that. So I'll refrain from further comments and
let them go. Well, I'll just add a comment, which is one way to think about the language here is that we're actually restoring the status of a program that's been at the agency for many, many years. Okay, with that, Representative McFarland. Representative Sands renews his motion that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All right. So it's laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Sands. We're going to move on. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
You're welcome.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair, have we approved the minutes yet?
Oh, well, would you like to?
I would like to move approval of the minutes from Wednesday, March 7 and Friday, March 9, while Representative Benson gets ready.
Yeah. Representative Morgan moved the approval of the last 2 minutes, as indicated. Any discussion on the minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevailed, and the minutes are approved and adopted. Thank you. Representative Benson, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 1233 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. And as your witnesses are getting ready, let me just introduce to the members here the ninth grade students from the St. Louis Park High School who are participating in Voice of the People today. Want to just stand up and be recognized? Students, welcome to the committee. Okay, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very pleased to be here today to move a bill which I think is one of the essential bills for this legislative session. We all have been here long enough, especially those of us who are new to the legislature, to understand that the resources of the state are limited, which means we have to set up a hierarchy of needs. And I want to emphasize the word needs over wants. I have a number of other bills that I want the legislature to enact, but today I have a bill which I believe is or ought to be at the top of the hierarchy of needs that this legislature will meet. And that has to do with food assistance. The food shelf program provides food to low-income individuals and families who have exhausted other resources to meet their basic nutritional needs. The state presently, in 2007, is spending about $1,278,000 in food assistance. The question before the committee this morning is whether or not the additional appropriation we are seeking is excessive. I do not believe it is. So the question is this an unreasonable request, considering all the other needs the state is going to be trying to meet this legislative session? And that is the question I'd like the committee to consider. And to assist us in that consideration, it is a witness today who I would like to introduce. Jane?
No, Colleen Moriarty.
Colleen, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Colleen Moriarty, who is Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my pleasure to bring forward several witnesses today who will make a brief comment about the need that is currently being felt by the citizens in the state of Minnesota when it comes to food support and nutritional assistance.
Ms. Moriarty, I guess for the tape, would you just reintroduce yourself, please?
Absolutely. My name is Colleen Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota.
Thank you.
My organization, Hunger Solutions Minnesota, represents food banks and food shelves throughout the state of Minnesota. Hunger continues to be a pressing issue in our state. Between 2000 and 2004, we saw a 45% increase in the amount of in the use of food shelves throughout the state of Minnesota. The funding request before you directly matches that increase. There has been no increase to these state funds since 1995. In fact, according to the study that our organization does every 5 years, since 1985, there's been a 90% increase in the amount of food assistance that's been given to the citizens in the state of Minnesota. The greatest growth has been in suburban Minnesota and in rural Minnesota, and in some western suburbs of the Hennepin County, we've seen an 80% increase. Joining me today are three witnesses who will give you both the rural, greater Minnesota perspective from a food bank. R. Jane Brown, who's the Executive Director of Second Harvest Heartland. Dan Foxworth from Neighborhood House in St. Paul, which will, he will give you an urban perspective. And Shirley Bueller from ICA in Minnetonka will give you a suburban flavor of what it is to remain in the frustrated state that food shelves throughout the state of Minnesota are in currently with our inability to be able to meet the pressing needs of our citizens. So I will introduce them one by one. Joining us first is Jane Brown from Second Harvest Heartland.
Welcome, Ms. Brown. We want to hear from all of you, and I just want to mention to you if you could try to keep your comments a little bit succinct. We have a session that we have to go to, and we do want to hear from you, so go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jane Brown. I'm the Executive Director of Second Harvest Heartland, and Second Harvest is a food bank. It's not a food shelf, so I want to be real clear. I'm not here speaking on behalf of our receiving funds. It's on behalf of the food shelves that are our distribution network. Just to add to some of the statistics, 93% of the people who use food shelves are citizens. I want you to understand who uses food shelves, because I think that's widely misunderstood. 78% are registered voters. 39% live in rural or suburban communities. 47% of households rely on paid income. 29% of households live on Social Security or SSI. 50% of the households have children under the age of 18. Minnesota has 140,000 households that are chronically food insecure, hungry, or at risk of hunger. I would like for you to understand the system as it works. I represent one of the six food banks that serve the state. The others are located in Crookston, Grand Rapids, Duluth, Rochester, and Fargo. We're located here in the Twin Cities area. They receive food and distribute it to over 300 food shelves statewide. Food banks receive and then distribute more than 40 million pounds of food annually, and the retail value of this donated food is $60 million. Over 90% of the food is donated primarily from our large food producers and grocers. And food shelves are our front line in providing food to hungry people. Without food shelves, food banks would not be able to distribute all of this food. It's a public-private partnership. Hunger Relief in Minnesota is a partnership between nonprofits, business, state, and federal agencies. Minnesota food producers, such as General Mills, Hormel, Golden Plump, and others, donate valuable food products for distribution, and the USDA provides millions of pounds of surplus commodities for distribution. To distribute the food to those in need requires food shelves and enough financial resources for them to do the job. Food shelves are amazing. Last year, Minnesota food shelves handled 1.8 million visits. That's an increase of over 500,000 visits since 2001. They distributed over 50 million pounds of food a year. They do this with the funding they currently have, which is $1.278 million. That costs the state 0.026, so less than 3 cents a pound to distribute. This covers the food, acquiring and transporting the food to the food shelf, facility costs, space, utilities, etc., staff or minimally volunteer coordination, storage, including refrigeration, and all of the reporting and eligibility requirements. The new funding will move them to 0.037, so that's less than 4 cents a pound. So, and this includes hamburger, fruits, vegetables, cereals, milk. So you can imagine how extremely important this is. Food shelves are community-based organizations. Most of them are connected with churches, but not all of them. All food shelves need funds to maintain their effective facilities and equipment. Rural food shelves are particularly facing daunting challenges. Most of them are underfunded because their communities are smaller or poor. And scarce funding makes it difficult to maintain equipment and facilities, much less increase their capacity to meet the rising need. 47% of the people that use food shelves work. We need for food shelves to have extended hours, either in the evenings or on weekends, to serve this population. Minnesota is a food-rich state. The state's food banks are able to secure large donations, but the full benefit of abundant donated food will not necessarily reach those in need unless the food shelves increase their capacity. The request for a biennial increase of $1.15 million in additional food shelf funding is small when measured against the operational efficiency of a system that has struggled to meet a 45% increase in visits. The request for a biennial increase of $1.15 million in additional funding looks even smaller when measured against the immediate and long-term health and welfare of the children, seniors, and working adults who must depend at times on food shelves to provide them with adequate nutrition. Thanks, Madam Chair, for the opportunity, and I'd like to turn it over to Dan Hawksworth.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hawksworth. Introduce yourself at the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, elected representatives. My name is Dan Hawksworth. I am president of Neighborhood House. Last time I was here, I shared with you a perspective of hunger, and I hope you remember as you make your decisions today, the face of Anna, who I shared that story with you, because really hunger is about children in Minnesota. Over 50% of those who benefit from food shelves are children across our state. Just to reconnect and give you some perspective of the size of the request before the state, our operating budget for Neighborhood House's food shelf is $582,000. This request on an annualized basis is about $575,000. So you are funding one food shelf out of all the 300 or more food shelves across the state of Minnesota. That's the leverage that you're getting in this request. I'll give you another example. This month alone, we will be doing our March Minnesota Food Share Drive. In that, we will raise over 140,000 pounds of food combined in food and dollars. 140,000 in 1 month. That will last us about 3 months, 3 to 4 months in our food shelf. and then we'll have to raise more food. But that is all coming through private sector, faith communities, coming together, and volunteers coming together with food drives. So we have corporate involvement, we have grocery store involvement, and we have volunteers who are taking that to their faith communities. And it truly is a true collaborative approach to working to end hunger in our state. To remind you, you heard the stats about our growth of hunger and the demand from 45% over the last few years to, you know, even 90% when you look longer. Our experience at Neighborhood House is much more substantial. In 1999, we provided 75,000 pounds of food. In 2005, 238,000 pounds of food, a threefold increase. Last year, we increased our capacity to 360,000 pounds of food. And this year, we're already on pace to increase that to 420,000 pounds of food. So just this, in the first 2 months of this year, we have provided service to 1,100 households, 5,708 people, and over 70,000 pounds of food. We would greatly appreciate your support of this bill and the leverage that you will provide to our efforts in providing this service to our community members. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hoskins. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Shirley Ehler, and I'm project coordinator for ICA, Intercongregation Communities Association, Representative Clark, and legislator. I'm here to put a personal faith on the food shelf for the people that Hunger Solutions and Second Harvest services, and we're the people who have direct contact with our customers, as we like to call them. Right now, we're dealing with conditions that we have not been able to tolerate. That's been two locations, and so we're excited because in another week we'll be moving into a new building. I want to tell you a little bit about that process. Without time and money, we have to use people power. And in that process, we have been using people power to do this move. We have used three Eagle Scouts that have helped us move our process forward. We're mentoring. We're making our community a better place for the people who are in it because they are investing in our organization as we move. We are doing this to provide better services. To be able to have this new building and put all of our services into one location, we're hoping to serve our customers better. We're hoping to meet their emergency needs before they become a crisis situation. And in fact, most of these people do not recognize an emergency need as the next step to a crisis situation. We're hoping to give them more personal care, to offer them more privacy when they come in. We're going to track them and follow them better. We're going to be able to hire some extra staffing with this money that's going to come from Hunger Solutions. We're going to have more dollars for more food. And this will allow us to buy more meat, produce, fresh milk, and non-food. It will also help us help with the energy costs, which are becoming a very, very big roadblock right now. We're finding families are getting their electricity cut off. They can't cut their gas off for their heat, but they can cut their electricity off, and that means no refrigerator and no light. So we're finding that we're giving out more financial assistance to help them be able to stay in an environment that is comfortable. We're also hoping that this money will help us provide gas vouchers, bus passes for them to stay in stable jobs. This is one of the biggest roadblocks, too, we see, is being able to keep them in housing and then finding out they can't keep the jobs to keep them in their housing. Our driving programs not only deliver groceries to people who do not have transportation, but they also offer a ride program for seniors for medical appointments. We find that our food services are staying steady in 2006, but our financial services in January and February of 2006 was 6 clients. In 2007, it was 32 clients. we're finding that the people are just not able to keep up with rent expenses, car repair, etc.
Ms. Fielder, I'm wondering if you could summarize a little bit. I want to give a chance for some questions.
I would ask that you approve this appropriation for Hunger Solutions.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Benson, how much of the money here has been is actually going to food? Because I see in this booklet here, and I hear from some of the testimony that we're talking about knitting needles here in this booklet, camcorders, flatbed carts, gift certificates, knitting needle. I already said that. I guess LC projectors. I'm just wondering if this is all going to food or if it's going to other things besides that. I'm concerned that we're deviating from the specific target that's been asked for.
Looks like we have a lot of people who want to answer that question.
I'm sure I will ask Colleen to address that.
Ms. Moriarty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the state appropriation that is allocated towards food shelf funding, 98% of it is used for the purchase of food. I do really congratulate my colleagues on wonderful testimony. However, I do need to reiterate the point that this food shelf funding is used for food and for some small amount of staffing and it is tracked and accounted for through the administration of both the Department of Human Services and Hunger Solutions Minnesota.
What may be confusing is that you see a newsletter from my entire organization.
Yeah.
Our food shelf is just one of those operations. So that is for programs outside of the food shelf. We track them by category, by each program area. So all the money that comes from this has been on food in our organization.
Thank you.
And food only.
Okay. Madam Chair. In the bill, it says here we're adding to the base for fiscal years 2008 and 2009, 2010, 2011. What is the base right now of the amount of money that the food shelf is receiving? How much will this add to the next 4 years?
The base in 2007 was $1,278,000 annually.
And Madam Chair, how much will this add then to the base?
A little under $1 million.
For the next 4 years?
Is that empty?
Madam Chair, for the next 4 years.
1.15 million.
That's for
the biennium. For the biennium.
For the biennium. So you're $3 million for the next 4 years. So you're gonna make it four. What's the governor's recommendation? Madam Chair, what's the governor's recommendation for food shelf as far as his target?
Representative Benson.
It's to maintain the current level, and that current level has been going on since what year? Since 1995, there has not been an increase.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? Thank you, Representative Benson, for bringing this bill. I just want to add my own thought that I think is a really important bill. I appreciate you bringing it before us.
Just the final comment. I'm asking here for additional resources for the most fundamental human need, food. And for those in the legislature and in our society who believe in preserving life in the broadest definition of that term, food assistance ought to be at the very top of any hierarchy of need. And so I strongly urge my colleagues to affirmatively vote for this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Benson. We have one more bill we're going to try to get through, members. It's Representative Medora. Welcome to the committee. And I believe there's a handout that we want to... He's looking at here?
One half is you have the money for the same money for the next 4 years. Add it to the base.
Representative Medora, welcome to your committee. And then you have a witness, several witnesses.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. We'll try, members, we're going to try to get through this before we go to session, so we've got about 20 minutes, and then we're all going to walk real fast. So, go ahead,
Chair. Members, today we're here to hear House File 724, which is an appropriation of $7.5 million to assist with ending family homelessness. and Prevention Services. I have two testifiers with me today, and for the sake, I will forego my okay. comments on the bill and let them speak to the bill.
Representative Madure, I think you probably want to move your...
I'm sorry, Bruce. Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that this that House File 724 be laid over. That's
possible
for
inclusion,
for
in
possible the inclusion into the omnibus bill.
There you go. Thank you. Welcome to the tape. Introduce yourself, please, to the tape.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Homelessness hurts children. Three-quarters of homeless children perform below grade level in reading, and more than half below grade level in math. Homelessness has become a common, unexpected reality for women fleeing violence. And homelessness is threatening more and more families, as one out of every eight Minnesota households is paying more than 50% of their income for housing. As you will also hear today, homelessness is costly. It is also unnecessary. In Minnesota, we have a number of programs that do an excellent job of addressing homelessness when it happens and preventing it in the first place. And the program we're going to talk about today has been cited as a national best practice on prevention. Minnesota's Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program has been used as a model for this state of Illinois and many cities across America for how to prevent homelessness. And I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking to you about that. The Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program is a flexible program that is... goes to the Housing Finance Agency. It can be used to assist families, youth, single adults who are homeless or at risk of homelessness, and there are three broad categories that it must address, that we ask the communities to consider addressing. One is homelessness prevention, stopping it before it starts. Second, shortening the length of stay in shelters and time that a household is homeless. And third, eliminating repeat episodes of homelessness. These are three broad categories, and they're meant to be broad because we want to give local ownership to how do we prevent homelessness in communities across the state. And there are collaborations in the metro area on a county basis. In greater Minnesota, there will be maybe multi-county collaborations that come together and try to figure out how can they do innovation? How can they overhaul the homelessness system in their area so that they can best meet those program goals, but make it unique to what their community needs are? And you'll hear from Dakota County one example of how they decide to prevent homelessness and how they're showing tremendous results based on their work. According to 2006 data from the Housing Finance Agency, the Family Homeless Prevention Program assisted 5,757 unduplicated households, including over 16,000 people, at an average cost of $625 per household. The average income for these households was shy of $15,000. This included over 9,500 children that were helped. Nearly an equal amount had to be turned away from the Family Homeless Prevention Program. And as you will hear, at such a dramatic cost savings that we are able to do when we prevent homelessness as opposed to dealing it once it's already happened, we shouldn't be turning anybody away from the Family Homeless Prevention Program. We should be doing all we can to help everybody who comes to the door and is eligible. That is why this program has received broad support from this committee. It's also why Governor Pawlenty has recommended, as this legislation does, doubling the amount of resources for the Family Homeless Prevention Program. I'm going to turn this over to Mary Beth Lundeen with Dakota County to talk to you about their program, but I want you to, if you can, just take a look at the second slide here. It talks about how prevention works. Very good success figures for the households that we help with the Family Homeless Prevention Program. This is a wise investment. This will greatly reduce the number of families that are at risk of homelessness, and so I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Mary Beth Lundeen from Dakota County Social Services, and I just want to say that Family Homeless Prevention funding has been critical to our community. There's a variety of sources of funding that we can use to assist families once they become homeless. We in Dakota County use this funding to prevent homelessness. A homeless episode can sometimes cost $15,000 or more,
And often a housing crisis we can resolve for less than $2,000. That's a significant savings for us. Not to mention the human toll for the people that are involved when they do become homeless. So we use these funds to support case management staff, as well as we set aside some funds that can actually be used to resolve the housing crisis when there's no other funding stream available to resolve that crisis. And what I want to do is just give you a couple of real-life examples where we were able to prevent homelessness. The first is a mother called us. It's a family, two-parent family, two children. Both children are disabled, but one significantly disabled, and so one parent needs to stay home to care for the children. The major wage earner, and they'd owned this home since 1986, the major wage earner was laid off and then had developed a very serious health crisis, and doctors had determined that he could not return to work, hence the house was in foreclosure. Sometimes we're able to assist with preventing foreclosure. In this situation, we couldn't, but with the case management services and some flexible funds, we were able to assist the family in moving from their home right into another apartment, and then we're able to temporarily subsidize that apartment until a more permanent rent subsidy could be maintained. And so for this family, had they become homeless, it would have been very difficult for them, because of the medical problems involved, to have had to have spent time in a motel or in a shelter. And so we were able to, while they had to move, we were able to avoid a homeless episode for this family. And they are now in a stable situation, and the children are very resilient and doing very well. The second one was referred to us by the Housing Authority as the house. They had gone to this home, single parent, three children, and it was in very serious disarray, and it would not pass housing inspection. And so the single parent was willing to work with the social worker, and we discovered that the parent was having a significant episode of depression, often not getting out of bed, and really had just fallen way behind in taking care of the home. And we were able to connect her with the necessary mental health services that helped stabilize her mental health. She is now doing better, and we're also able to assist with the cleanup and, again, avoid an eviction for this family. And so we have many situations like this where we not only help stabilize the family and help the children avoid homelessness, but it really does not cost very much to do this.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairman Medora, or the witnesses, where is the largest, I'm guessing that the largest homeless population is in the Seven County Metro or the Twin City area, and if you could just give me kind of a brief of where other populations are located, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I really wish that this hearing was taking place tomorrow at noon, because the Wilder Research Center is going to be releasing its study on homelessness that we do every 3 years. We go out and we survey thousands of people who are homeless, and we try to find out what are their gaps. So I can't tell you the details from that survey today, but I can tell you that based on the survey that we did 3 years ago, that one quarter of those who are experiencing homelessness at that point lived in Greater Minnesota. And then, of course, most of those who are homeless live in Hennepin and Ramsey County, but there's homelessness in every community. Every community, and we've actually heard a number of rural legislators on this committee talk about the increase in youth homelessness in their communities. So what I can commit to you, I don't want to provide you old data, is tomorrow provide you a breakdown of homelessness broken down on a what we call a continuum level. Southeast Minnesota will be able to tell you the number of people that are homeless in Southeast Minnesota, Northeast Minnesota, St. Louis County, Hennepin, Ramsey. We have breakdowns based on regional areas in Greater Minnesota and county levels in the metro area. But you're probably going to see that it breaks down based roughly on population. and that you have homelessness in every community, but the amount is distressfully concentrated where you have concentrated population.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dahl, how many, you mentioned that the governor has increased the amount of money or doubled the amount of money he's putting in his budget for homelessness. How many families or individuals are going to be added to this, to helping out with his budget? Or is this money here more than what the governor's offering, or about the same?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that our request is a couple thousand dollars extra. we basically want to get to around $15 million, which is the governor's recommendation as well. He's just shy of $15 million. And as I said, right now we're able to help roughly 5,700 unduplicated households with this program, and that we're turning over an equal about 5,900 families away from getting services. I can't say that we're going to be able to double services. We may actually be able to go beyond that. The reason I can't be specific is because this is a locally owned approach to homelessness, where in Representative Clark's community, they may decide to focus on victims of domestic violence and helping them move into a new household, if a place to live once they flee violence. Another community may choose a completely different approach that costs a little bit more, but because of housing in the community and their type of response. But I would venture to guess that we're going to be able to go a long way towards reducing these turnaway numbers if the number stays fairly static.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dahl, has there been any tracking done on individuals that have been helped through the homeless program in the situation where they've been able to come back in and add to society, say 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road? Has there anything been tracked on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we don't have we don't do that tracking. The Family Homeless Prevention Program does ask for reports on success 6 months and 12 months out. So that we can see that are we actually preventing homelessness over the long haul, and this is a national best practice because we are able to show that part out, it does work. Many of the people who become homeless or at risk of homelessness would rather that label not follow them forever, and so, they're not going to want to be talking to Mary Beth very long after they receive assistance. They want to get on with their life. But we are able to tell you that over the relatively short term of several months to a year out, that many of these households are not homeless. And their stories of success are they're working, contributing members of society. Their kids have been able to stay in school and perform well. And if you wanted us to provide some good anecdotes for what families have done. Many programs across the state have used these resources, and they are in contact with families that have been assisted.
Thank you. Okay. No further discussion? Okay, then move the House File 724 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and it will be laid over. Members, one announcement. We have a meeting tonight at 5. To continue on, we have several bills on the agenda. If the meeting has been moved from 500 South to 400 North, so please make notice of that. 400 North is where we'll be located, a little smaller room. Okay. And we'll send an email to remind your staff as well. So with that, members, the meeting is adjourned.
I'm going to call the Housing Policy, Finance, and Public Health Finance Division to order. We have two bills today, and we're going to start with Representative Lane's bill. We don't quite have a quorum, but we'll get started anyway. This is a family visiting program. Welcome to your committee, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 595 for what? Approval, pass, layover, whatever we're doing with it.
We'll be laying it over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
And then I would like to move a delete all DE2.
Okay, DE2 amendment. Representative Lane moves the delete all amendment 59 DE2 to put the bill in the order that she wants it in. Okay.
Okay.
And that's a courtesy. We'll discuss that as the bill then. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Oh, we don't have enough people to vote yet. Never mind. We're going to go ahead as if
Okay. You can talk to that, and as soon as we get a quorum, we'll go ahead and thank you.
All right. So I'll do a quick summary and then clarify some of the changes on the seat. All this very brief, and speak a little bit to the bill, and then have a couple testifiers. So this bill updates the language that's already in Minnesota statute on family home visiting for the first years of life, and it appropriates additional funds to this targeted family home visiting program. Proposed new language uses a multidisciplinary approach and coordination between different systems that already exist to assist families of young children. It clarifies the duties of the State Health Department for training, technical assistance, and outcome measurements. What this bill does not do, it doesn't change the focus of the program. It's still voluntary, always has been, still is, targeted to low-income needy families. All families in the program are given information about the purpose of the program, and they sign written consent forms. This bill does not change any of the consent provisions that are in law now. This bill does not require any new data collection. It doesn't change any of the data practices provisions that govern the current program. No data on individuals is collected and sent to the State Department. The delete all amendment gets it in the same order that it's now in the Senate. And that's mostly technical movement of things around. The only piece that's, there's one little piece added on 4.35, where one of the things that's added to the outcome measures is rates of at-risk populations reached. So that's just another area that will be identified in the outcomes. And then the other thing it does, and that's the only major piece, is that it actually takes out identification of children with a MARS number, where they'd be assigning a MARS number that they would get in school. This was to assign it earlier so that we could at least track and see how well they did. But that's too complicated. Too many systems crossed, too many departments crossed, so it's not feasible. So that has been removed. We have no assignment of a MARS number in this bill. With that, I would just like to say that I speak often about healthy brain development, and speaking of the developmental sequence of the brain growth, in the early years, there is a lot that either happens or doesn't happen. And we know what it takes to support this healthy development, and many families just do it naturally. They provide the safety, the nurturing and responsive care, the bonding, the interactive activities, all which are crucial for the development of the brain that leads to later academic learning. But some do not. They do not understand what it takes. They do not have the circumstances of life that provide the safety and nurturing care, and they never had the modeling of how to be a good parent. So this seeks to find those situations and help provide this basic care for the child so that this cycle can be broken and we can have good outcomes later. So I actually believe that this early care is the only thing that will actually change the achievement gap that we run into later in school. It begins in the early years. I would like to refer to, you have several things in your packet, but I'd like to refer to David Brooks, national columnist, I understand, a Republican columnist in the New York Times. His editorial, published March 1st in the Star and Tribune, is A Critique of Pure Reason. And he speaks to conventional candidates for the presidency coming up. We'll talk about improving schools, blank slates in children, efficient delivery systems, but the creative ones will speak about the lives of children, relationships, and will emphasize that family relationships matter more than anything else. So the fifth paragraph down, they will understand that schools filled with students who can't control their impulses, who can't focus their attention, who can't regulate their emotions, will not succeed, no matter how many reforms are made by governors, superintendents, or presidents. This is, I think, just key. And it's also the controlling of impulses and attention are all factors that are necessary for learning. They go hand in hand. So he emphasizes that this all begins at the dawn of life, builds in the early in life as children learn how to learn. And he goes on and speaks on the next page where he asks, what can government do about any of this? And says, The answer is there are programs that do work to help young and stressed mothers establish healthier attachments. These programs usually involve having nurses or mature women make a series of home visits to give young mothers the sort of cajoling and practical wisdom that in other times would have been delivered by grandmothers or elders. And then give some examples of these programs across the nation and comments on their impressive results. So I was just pleased to see this in the paper a couple of weeks ago. And here is the same feeling that I have, that this is the place where we actually make the changes that we are looking for down the line in the outcomes with children. And let's see, with that, I would like to bring forth Art.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll introduce yourself with the record, please.
I'm Rob Grunewald, Associate Economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And as I've reviewed Bill 595, I want to reflect just a little bit on the research that helps back the return on investment we might find in investing in and home visiting programs that are articulated in the bill. When Art Rolnick, our director of research at the Minneapolis Fed, and I reviewed the research in early childhood development, we're convinced that this really is the key time in which the brain is developing. In fact, by the age of 3, 85% of the architecture of a young child's brain is essentially formed. So these early environments are going to impact the beginnings of this child's life, not only in school, but later on in life. And if children who are in settings that are more disadvantaged in their nature can be reached with a high-quality home visiting program, they have a better chance of arriving at school prepared to learn and succeed later on in life. And in fact, there is demonstration of there being a sizable public return. For example, I'll speak about a couple programs nationally. The Nurse Family Partnership Program is one that provides registered nurses for at-risk mothers prenatal through the first 2 years of a child's life. And this program used a randomized trial across three different sites, including Elmira, New York, Memphis, and Denver. And over the past 30 years, they found effects in two or more of these trials, such as improved prenatal health, fewer subsequent pregnancies, increased intervals between births, fewer childhood injuries, improved school readiness, and increased maternal employment. A cost-benefit analysis by RAND Corporation of the Elmira, New York study showed a $5 return for every dollar that was invested in the program, and more than half of the returns were attributed to savings to government due to reduction in welfare costs and criminal justice costs and also increased tax revenue. Researchers at the Washington State Institute for Public Policy estimate that the cost-benefit ratios for the Nurse Family Partnership Project and other home visiting programs for at-risk mothers range between $2 and $3 for every dollar invested in the program. So they certainly pay for themselves back, and they achieve a high return above and beyond that one-to-one ratio. A randomized trial of the Healthy Families New York program, which provides home visits by trained paraprofessionals to new or expectant mothers deemed at risk of abusing or neglecting their children, demonstrated that mothers in the program reported committing fewer acts of abuse and neglect during the child's first 2 years of life than mothers that were in a control group. And while a cost-benefit analysis of this program wasn't conducted, it seemed that the type of benefits that were achieved would later achieve some savings to government. With children off to a better start, government saves money. The children are more likely to do better in school. They're more likely to participate in society, in democratic society later on, and in the quality workforce, which is key to economic development. Parents, and particularly mothers, are more likely to continue their schooling and retain employment, reducing the need for other more costly social services. Looking in particularly in Minnesota, there are three counties that use the Nurse Family Partnership Project, Clay, Wilkin, and St. Louis counties. In Dakota County, a study of an enhanced version of the Healthy Families America model that I just discussed indicated a reduction in the number of child protection cases and other areas of cost savings to government. Public health nursing models can also be effective in reaching at-risk mothers. As a board member of the Minnesota Minnesota Visiting Nurse Agency, I've had a chance to observe firsthand the work that public health nurses do in the home on two different occasions. And it seems the nurses develop a trusting relationship with the mothers and impart the type of criteria, the type of items that you had listed in this bill. Data from the Minnesota Visiting Nurse Agency shows that clients were more likely to stay in school. They had a high retention rate in school and graduation rates. They were likely to delay pregnancy. Their births, 94% of their births were at a healthy weight, and 97% of children after birth were up to date on their immunizations. This bill focuses on children who are at risk. This is where we'd expect to achieve the highest public rate of return. The bill also emphasizes quality, which is important for home visiting programs. And I also note that the program is also including language to help mothers and parents shop for quality early learning programs once their children are older, which is also another important provision later on in that child's life. Thank you.
Before we get our next witness, let me just say we have a quorum, so let's put the bill in the order that the author had requested. And that was the amendment that ends in DE2. So, if there's any discussion on that, all those in favor of adopting the amendment to DE2, indicate by saying aye.
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 As you wish. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, I'm Rob Fulton. I'm director of the St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health. We're a large, full-service local public health department serving St. Paul and Ramsey County. We're members of the Local Public Health Association of Minnesota, and Ramsey County is a member of the Association of Minnesota Counties. And both of these state organizations, along with Ramsey County, support this legislation. Ramsey County Board has set as our public health's highest priority to assure that every child 0 to 6 is safely nurtured. And to that end, the largest section of the 10 sections in our public health department is our healthy family section. It has a staff of over 70, a budget of $5.6 million a year, and the county board provides $1.9 million of that $5.6 million from local levy. When I testified 3 weeks ago, I had with me a client by the name of Judy. And Judy, unfortunately, because of daycare, can't be here today. But she has given me written permission to share with you some of the things she shared with the earlier committee. She says, I would never have read to my baby or thought of getting books, and my public health nurse brought books to me and taught me what things I need to do with my children to make me better meet their needs and be a good mother. My public health nurse helped me learn many things my mother was not able to teach me, such as caring for children, being a good mother, and realizing that I really could graduate from high school and do some positive things that no one else in my family had done. My five-year-old, Judy is 18, my five-year-old is really smart and helps the preschool teachers at childcare translate what the other children are saying. He's already enrolled in the St. Paul Magnet School for kindergarten. I will graduate this spring at the age of 18 from Arlington High School. In January, I was student of the month at Arlington. I think I am the first teen mother to be homecoming queen for Arlington High School. This past summer, I was worker of the month at a summer job. I now live in stable housing with responsible adults other than my mother, and I've been accepted into the Promise of You program with St. Paul College and hope to become a nurse. Let me add just a few more points to those comments. Our program is a voluntary family home visiting program. It's been in existence for over 30 years, and it's grown each year to today we have 900 families that we're serving that are currently open for our services. We have a focus on adolescents. Our board really believes that if you don't get on top of adolescent parents and they don't get their high school education, you're going to find them 5 years, 60 months later at the end of their MPhil and not being able to move forward. And they've given us a focus on adolescent parents. Last year we served over 500 adolescent parents. We have some evaluation data from the services that we provide. At the completion of services, when our nurses are through with their services, which sometimes, like in the case of Judy, is almost 4 years in time length, 96% of the children are up to date on their well-child exams and immunizations. 95% of the families showed positive parent-child attachment. 100% of the children had health insurance. And only 3% of the mothers who enrolled in our program had a subsequent pregnancy as an adolescent. And finally, most importantly, 60% of our adolescent mothers completed high school. Since the funding reductions to public health that came out of the 2003 session, we've had to reduce the number of families we serve by 20%. Again, I would encourage you to consider this bill. I know you're going to be challenged for dollars, but we think this is an important step as part of a program to really assure that our kids are ready for school. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Fulton here, I would just like to, he told me at one point the number of births in Ramsey County and the number that are born into poverty.
I can tell you that in 2006 we had 7,543 births in Ramsey County, of Ramsey County residents, and 3,838 of those births were in the publicly funded healthcare system. That's 51% of our births that were part of the publicly funded healthcare system and who were seen then in our child and teen checkup. There are probably many more that aren't part of that system. We believe our WIC program serves more than that 3,800. They serve something close to 4,500. So there may be even higher. But I'm very assured that 51% of the births in Ramsey County in 06 were to children in poverty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other comment that I've heard in the past is, where do we find these parents, these moms? And it's through the high schools, it's through the WIC program, it's through things like that that are already in existence. We're not searching out to ID people that aren't already out there and known and saying, you could use a public health nurse, would you like one?
Any questions from committee members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to the author, I'm just wondering if the Department of Health has had some... have you been working with the Department of Health on this particular bill?
Right. A lot of the revisions have come with their health.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, is there a fiscal note attached to this?
Madam Chair, Representative... there is one in the works. It's not in a form to come forth right now. The Department of Health has worked through the numbers. When it says at the back of the bill how much they would use, 10% or 5% to do some of the parts that the Department of Health is keyed into. They have those numbers now. They just don't have it in an order they can hand out, but they can testify to that if you would like. As far as the appropriations, which aren't in here, I will tell you... right now, we have $4 million a year provided through TANF funds, and Governor Pawlenty is seeking an additional 2.5 for 08, an additional 5.5 for 09. And what we are seeking is to raise those numbers so that it would be a total of 10 each year. And that would put it, that wouldn't quite restore it to when it was reduced in, I believe, 03. But it would come close.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lane. I guess one of the questions I've got here, I know that it sounds like this is already being taken place and it's fairly effective, and I'm wondering what the criteria is. Where is the line that we draw to say here are the ones at risk and then there are the others that we do not serve?
Ramsey County has focused on two areas. One of those are adolescents, 17 and younger, who are required now by state law to have a visit and a plan developed for them to assure that they're capable of parenting properly. Once that assessment is done with the adolescents, they are offered services. They can choose not to have those services, and a number of them do. We also have a focus on 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, particularly those that have not completed high school. It is our board's belief that as we've examined the MFIP program and the MFIP Employment Services program, that 50% of the cases that we see at the end of those 60 months enter the program as adolescent parents. And if they don't get that high school education, they don't get into a viable job that they can move forward on. And that's the primary criteria that our board is looking at. We've reduced our caseload about 20% since 2003. We'd like to serve 21 and 22-year-olds. We're not able to do that right now. Our funding is tight again. We're planning probably to cut back with 20-year-olds next year in order to assure that we can focus on those.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Any members? If not, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in opposition? If not, the bill is before us. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Housing and Public Health. There you go. Thank you, Ms. Simpson. We now have House File 939 before you. Thank you. So we have some extra seats here now for those of you who are standing. Come on in. Sorry, we're in such a small room today. This is an important bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I would like to make a motion that 939 be rolled into the omnibus bill for this committee.
Rolled into it, all right. And I believe you have an amendment or not?
I do not at this
time.
You
do not, okay. Representative Pan.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Let me tell you a little bit about this bill. It's kind of been a fun experience, if you can say fun, one way to describe it. Many of you know, and the committee members, that there's one group that opposes this bill. You've probably heard a few emails from them. And what I want you to just think about is, while we're going through the presentation today, for every one of those mass-produced emails that you got from the Realtors Association, there's probably at least 10 people within your district that this bill would help. So just kind of consider that email blitz that we got. There's quite a few members out there of our constituency that would really benefit from these programs. It's been a struggle for me, members, and maybe you can appreciate it. As you know, I represent the northern suburbs of the Twin Cities. It's a relatively conservative area. I have a large number of my constituents who are in the labor force. We're a working class, middle class family type of area, and housing issues range from anywhere between mold and new construction to box elder bug infestation on the outside that some of you can relate to. And so I came down here as an educator, and I was looking for the basic things that we're looking for: a fair tax system that addresses basic needs like education, transportation, and health care. And then I got on this committee. And all these needs came before us, and it was challenging to try to figure out, where does housing fit in to this mix that we decided to come down here and try to help people out? And what impact would it have? So I started looking at the basic issues that I ran on, and I might add that one of those was property tax reduction to make sure that people who grew up in our communities could actually retire in our communities and afford to live in the homes that they bought when their property taxes go up more than the mortgage they used to pay on their home. To me, there's something wrong with that. So I started looking at these issues, and I said, you know what, let me see education. I'm a high school teacher. I know a lot of my students and families are transient. In some cases, you'll find numbers in the suburban areas of 35% or greater of our students start in a school district and don't finish in the same school district. Why is that? Housing issues. Okay? Housing issues is a foundational structure of our kids and their educational progress. So I started looking at it and said, wow, you know, transportation, boy, it's a mess. We got people traveling further and further, spending more gas and more time, and they're clogging up roads in my district, Highway 65 and 35W and Lake Drive. It's a mess. Well, if we had affordable housing, more affordable housing in the North Metro, people wouldn't be traveling as far to get to places where they work. And I started looking at, boy, health care. Boy, really nice to get health care. We could fix the problems with health care. And then we start talking about things in this committee like lead paint, mold in our homes, and how does that impact our healthcare system? How does that impact our kids in our schools? And I said, you know, boy, we should really solve these issues, and I really like to work toward trying to find solutions. Then this came along, and I said, wow, you know, I guess we could spend over and over again the limited resources that we have, and I could put a number out there and say, wow, you know, we're going to go for $1 million, $2 million, fix this problem. But the problem is that everybody seems to be spending that money over and over again. So I could conservatively say, well, you know, I'll just throw it in there, I'll get my name in lights, and I'm really not going to solve the problem, but I'm just going to get it out there. But we chose a responsible funding mechanism in the housing market to use money that is from a house to go into solving so that people can have a house. And so that's why we decided to run this route. And that's why, yes, it's not very popular, I'll admit, to use the T word around here. But if you want to get something done and you want to answer for it and you want to be responsible fiscal restraint and good investment, you have to find a mechanism that works. We chose this mechanism. It's not something that we just thought of. There's been a significant amount of research that's been done into this area, and the benefits, I'm sure people that are working with this will be able to eloquently explain to you today. But when you consider that your home and the tax deductions that you take on an annual basis over the lifetime of owning that home, and you compare that with the couple $100, maybe $300, depending on the value of your home, at the time of sale only, not refinance, at the time of sale, to go into a matching dollar program for affordable housing. And that's a huge definition there of what affordable housing is. And they'll speak to this as well. But when one out of eight of our homeowners are spending more than 50% of their income on their home, that to me is not home. That's not affordable housing. So I could go on and on about my experience with this and possible ways to fund it and alternative ways and mechanisms. And I've done everything from a STEP program to deductions to figuring out how to a way to make this work. And so I want you to listen today to the testimony, and if for no other reason, help me find a solution that we all can get behind and support. It's been an interesting adventure. I appreciate all of your indulgence here as I get on my soapbox, but I will now turn it over to the bill and people who have worked with this for a long time and who are very experienced in this area. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and Representative Krantz made me smile. I actually want to say that listening to the bill before this was amazing to hear, and a lot of the issues that this committee has heard over the past several weeks, you get to make a big difference in this committee with the issues that you will be struggling with, and I certainly hope you get adequate funding to be able to address all those issues. And this bill is one way to help in one portion of what you're responsible for, which is affordable housing. I am privileged to testify in support of the Housing Solutions Act, House File 939. As was already stated, one out of eight Minnesota households pays more than 50% of their income for housing. Tonight, 10,000 individuals will be homeless in this state, and another 10,000 to 13,000 will be precariously housed. Representatives, we must find a way to keep it so that not so many households are living paycheck to paycheck, unable to afford their rent or mortgage. We must declare it unacceptable that there are people who are living on our streets. And the phrase precariously housed or couch hopping has got to become something that does not describe the reality for so many Minnesotans. Despite these terrible statistics and despite the terrible conditions, you know that Minnesota's affordable housing budget has taken a beating over the past several biennia. And you have a chart that illustrates this. I'd like you to take a look at this. Back in 2000-2001, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency had over $170 million to help buy down the cost of housing for our lowest income households. Some of this money was base, some of it was one time in nature. All of it was needed. We had no trouble finding a way to effectively use these funds. Today we have about $70 million. $100 million has vanished, and that's not even counting the impact of inflation. Committee members, we need bold action. We need you to support the Housing Solutions Act. The Housing Solutions Act does three things. I'm just going to do a brief overview, and then if there are questions, we can take them. But I want to talk about the strategies and then also how this would raise the money. The first thing we would do is we would use a portion of the funds that we raise, 42% of them, in fact, for rental assistance to extremely low-income households. And this would go through the Housing Trust Fund. You've heard a lot of information about the Housing Trust Fund over the past several weeks. Our Housing Finance Agency is the department that is responsible for working with those funds. We're able to get those to households that make under $8,000 a year, the average of $8,000 a year, effectively getting them into housing stability. So a lot of the money going for rental assistance, not construction, but using the existing market as a way to help people into housing stability. Secondly, we know that a number of employers want more workforce housing in their communities, and the Challenge Program has been an effective program to help us to build more housing in communities that need it. 33% of the funds would go for the Challenge Program. And then lastly, there's a local incentive fund called HALO, and I, for the life of me, even though I've been working on this issue for quite some time, I can't remember what HALO stands for, but it's essentially a local incentive fund where if local government will put up some money, land, some sort of resource in the construction of affordable housing, we'll match it with state dollars, and we have a part of this bill that says some of it has to go to Greater Minnesota because this is a statewide issue. Accomplishing this, we would accomplish this through what is a small surcharge on the state's deed tax. Right now, Minnesota's deed tax is 0.33%. This would raise it to 0.5%, and that increase would be used to fund these three programs. According to the last forecast, that would raise about $53 million every year. If the housing market is stronger, a couple of forecasts ago, it would raise about $80 million. It follows the housing market so that when housing is more expensive and lower income people can't afford to get into the housing that's there, we're able to raise more to help them into that housing. So it's quite intentional, the source of funding that we chose. As Representative Grant Krantz already said, there's been a lot of commotion about this. And I want to use my home as an example to point out why I think this is the right thing to do. I bought my home in 1998. For $115,000. I got it reappraised in 2004, and I was told, shocker, it was worth $208,000. I have made $93,000, and I've done nothing but live in the place. If I sold that home, that's wealth that I acquired, and it's not going to go taxed. This proposal would say that when you sell your home, 0.17% of that is actually going to go back into the housing market to help low-income people into home ownership opportunities or to rental assistance to be stable in housing that exists in the community. And every year, I have a mortgage interest deduction that I claim on my federal taxes that benefits me by $3,000. And many of us benefit from this. So at the time that I sell my home, I might have to pay an extra $400 for those thousands upon thousands of dollars of tax benefits and wealth that I've taken advantage of. And I'm happy to do that. And I think that there's a lot of people in the community, many you might see behind me, who also say that they'd be happy to do that. So I ask you to please, please support the Housing Solutions Act. Before I turn it over, I just want to say that we've heard a lot of opposition to this, and some of it has been we're spending too much on affordable housing and homelessness issues. And how much money are we spending federally, state, local? How much money is going into this? And this committee has heard how much federal money is there, how much federal money has been cut. How much state money is there, how much state money has been cut. You've seen that. The charts have come before here, and I'm happy to share this with anybody who wants to ask that question. I'm also happy to tell any of them, if they think that there's too much money going into affordable housing and homelessness programs, that there's plenty of people in this audience who would be happy to take them to a shelter tonight. We need more money. This is a shame. We need to do something about it. The Housing Solutions Act helps us accomplish that. Thank you.
Mr. Bell. Next witness.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Monica Williams. I've been a real estate professional for 35 years. I'm a homeowner in this state for 30 and have lived in Bloomington for the last 20 years. Now, picture yourself sitting at your dining room table with your realtor, and he or she gives you a market analysis, the range of prices that similar homes in your neighborhood have been selling for. Sound familiar? Together, you come up with a listing price, and your realtor has then prepared an estimated net proceeds worksheet listing all the costs of selling based on 100% sales price, maybe 95, maybe 90. They assure you that your home should sell within that range. The cost of selling has all been listed: the mortgage payoff, the property tax proration, the cost from the title companies. Oh, then comes the real estate commission. That's the place where the realtor's marketing skills come in. Oh, and don't forget the Brokers Administration Commission, a fairly new revenue stream for the real estate companies, recording service fees, delivery service fees. I've heard no protests from the Association of Realtors on these other rising costs. Yes, the cost of selling a home goes up, but so does the selling price. In fact, 50% from 2000 to 2005. The state fee tax is just a small percent of the fees associated with selling a home, a fee that has not gone up since 1987. The Minnesota Association of Realtors has given you a simple mantra in their recent handouts. Quote, we must live within our means. Yet, their handouts show samples after samples of citizens who have not lived within their means. Charts showing tapped out home equity, charts with rising mortgage payments on our mortgages, charts of rising foreclosures. They say a growing Minnesota economy is the best source for more revenue, not tax increases. Isn't a growing economy where everyone contributes and wins? Analysis of income trends show that the top 20% of earners see their income rising faster than the bottom 20%. One in 13 in our communities lived below the poverty line in 2004 and 2005. Poverty was the most prevalent among children. 1 in 10 children were growing up in poverty in 2004 and 2005. Who's winning? Between 1997 and 2001, the legislators passed 5 major tax cuts that reduced the mean, that state revenue stream, by $1 billion annually. By 2004, Minnesota economy had actually slowed down, and by 2005, the state for the first time was underperforming the nation. The people at the bottom are worse off, and the people at the top are better off, and the gap widens. So, does it not make sense that the area where the benefits from years of mortgage interest deductions, federal government mortgage initiatives, incentives, HUD mortgages, VA mortgages, and 50% equity increases should be where we should look for the means to move the bottom of our society up the ladder into shelter, supportive housing, workforce, affordable housing, The means must come from those in housing. The rest have not had those benefits. Until our workforce makes a wage to move out of poverty, society needs to provide the means. Until all children have a safe home to come home to every night, society needs to provide the means. Until the Minnesota economic growth covers everyone, society needs to provide the means. The Housing Solution Act asks for such a small increase in the state deed tax, a tax that hasn't risen since 1987, a dedicated fund for housing issues will help our economy grow. An economy where more of the bottom 20% have a chance to contribute, and then we all win. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mrs. Williams. Would you identify yourself and then proceed, please?
My name is Connie Coleman, and I'm a homeowner on the west side of St. Paul, and I'm a real estate agent with Edina Realty, and I support the Housing Solutions Act. I guess what I am particularly interested in is that this is attacking housing from a lot of different angles, from rental, home ownership, and private matching funds. And I think, you know, we say it over and over again here, but that by getting low-income citizens into long-term housing, that really strengthens our schools, which I think is a very important issue, with some of the schools in St. Paul having 60% of the kids that are there in the fall, not there in the spring in the same school because of housing issues. This helps lower the crime rate and stabilizes our neighborhoods. Just a couple of points, and I think we've gone over most of them, but maybe to emphasize them again. To state that I think for some people there's a little bit of clarification need that this is only when you sell your home is when the tax is on there, not when you're buying the home. And again, that was done after doing a lot of research and thinking about this, that we didn't want to affect first-time home buyers, and we also didn't want to double tax people if they were selling their home and then going ahead and buying another home. There has been a lot of talk about foreclosures, which has been extremely devastating for people. And basically how that happens is with the adjustable rate mortgages, people were getting into homes they really couldn't afford otherwise. And at the lower interest rate, they were able to make their payments, but as that payment went up, they were unable to make that payment. It's a really devastating situation. Increasing the state deed tax wouldn't add to the foreclosure problems in terms of adding monthly costs or yearly costs that people are paying on their home that is really the actual issue which leads to foreclosure. Another thing that we as real estate agents have been encouraged or told that's going to be difficult about the increasing the state deed tax is that we're going to have to explain to our clients that extra cost. And as Monica explained, well, we already spend a lot of time talking to our clients about costs. And the cost that I'm asked the most about is the extra line item that goes to our brokers that's above and beyond our personal commissions, which we pay part of that to our brokers, but then there's this extra line that's several hundred dollars, and I've heard rumor that a lot of the brokerages are going to be increasing that to about $500. And currently the tax, the increased tax that we're talking about is lower than that on, say, like a $200,000 home. And also to bring up the point that we've already talked about, a lot of us have owned our homes for a while. You know, I've owned my home for 13 years in a similar kind of dollar figure that my home has tripled in value in 13 years, which, you know, is great for me. But, again, that extra fee when selling it seems pretty small. And also about explaining to our clients, I got to tell you, the questions I'm asked on a really, really regular basis are, Is this a safe neighborhood? Are the schools good? Is there good management of rental units? If there's apartment buildings in the area, will my property hold its value? Those are really the questions that we get asked. People expect that there's a cost to doing business, but it's those values that people are concerned about. And I think by stabilizing housing, that really goes to answering a lot of those. So thanks for your time. Again, I would really ask for your support for the Housing Solutions Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Pass the microphone. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I think I know this testifier. Would you give us your name for the record, please?
I'm Judy List. I'm a volunteer with the National Council of Jewish Women, Representative Benson Committee. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon to talk on behalf of the Housing Solutions Act. I'm here representing not only National Council of Jewish Women, but also Hadassah, Jewish Community Action, Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Social Action Committee of Hadassah Sharon Synagogue. And I'm here because we feel a strong need for a steady stream of funding for affordable housing. And it's important that there are dedicated funds for this need, for this particular need in our community. The people who have testified before me, Representative Krantz and the others, have done a wonderful job of giving you compelling reasons for this particular bill. So I think I will just talk about my personal experience, which is my oldest daughter has a disability. She's a young adult, and I'm very limited income. And she's fortunate in that she has a Section 8. But what happened is that the maximum allowed for rental in the formula got lowered. And now, and she's in an apartment. She's got her services set up there, her transportation, everything that comes along with her needs. And all of a sudden, she's been the apartment has been outpriced because arbitrarily, the need to help others. So the maximum allowable rent was lowered, and it priced her out of that apartment, which creates a great deal of instability. And so there's just a huge need, and everyone's talked about that. And I just will be brief and conclude with all these things, the schools, the stability of the schools and education are reasons why all these organizations that I represent support this important funding stream. But I'm going to conclude with the phrase that we use that when we say, what a bargain. This Housing Solutions Act is a terrific bargain. We get affordable housing, stability for our communities, stability for our schools, and I think it's great. So I'm excited. I appreciate Representative Krantz's creativity in coming up with this wonderful bill, and I hope the committee will choose to support it. Thank you.
Ms. List. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Bill Keats. I'm a retired business executive from Lawson Software, and I spent a fair amount of my time in retirement advocating for affordable housing. That's the reason I'm here today. I obviously have strong feelings, having managed organizations up to 500 people, that I've seen not just the impact on families, but the impact on worker productivity when someone has a stable home or not. And I'll shorten my testimony about those kinds of things because I think you've heard a lot of the discussion. There's two things I'd like to bring up with you. One is we had a developer on schedule to report, and he was unable to make it because of a conflict, but I did carry with me a letter from him. And I'll just briefly let you know that he wanted to strongly encourage you to support this action because of the amount of private funds we can leverage against it. These funds leverage additional private and investment into a project about $5 to $6 for every dollar of state funding. So when we look at the amount that the state puts in fact, there's a lot more money that will be leveraged into these programs for affordable housing. So I'll leave you with a copy of his letter. The other thing I'd like to do is point out to you that I know you've received a lot of emails on this. On the support side, We have 200 organizations that have signed in support of this from a community. I'll leave those with you as well so that you can see the organizations that have signed up. And with Michael's help, this is a stack of individual signatures from the community, 2,500 so far, and we're still getting people to do it. And having personally gotten a number of these, I can attest that there's been, I think, out of the several hundred I've talked to, only two that would not sign it. The rest of them said, it makes sense to me. I've had appreciation on my house, or I will have. I know of other people that have, and I'd be more than willing to pay some on that, in that it has not been taxed up until this point. And when I sell my house, I would expect, if I had to pay a few hundred dollars, to bring people into the housing market that have not taken advantage of it. I'd be glad to do it. And that's usually what people will say and sign. There's 2,500 signatures there. I think that's a big statement from your constituents that says, not only do we need the problem solved, but this is a good solution.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else here present who would like to testify?
Mr. Chairman, could we ask the panelists some questions?
Yes, go ahead. Representative Schumpeter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions for Ms. Williams and Ms. Coleman. I find it kind of intriguing. Many of us received emails from realtors strongly opposing this, and you both said you were realtors. Some of the emails indicated that the Minnesota Association of Realtors are opposed to this bill. Are either of you members of the Minnesota Association of Realtors? Could you explain a little bit how the association came to take a stand against this? Were you all polled and asked your opinion or surveyed or anything? So neither of you were asked your opinion? Do you know how the association determines its position on policy issues like this? Do you have any idea?
Well, would one of you like to respond, maybe into the microphone?
Neither one of us are absolutely sure about that. I mean, there's an elected committee. Part of our keeping our licenses, being an annual fee to the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And there is a lobbying portion which we can choose to not be part of. Putting a fee into that part.
Representative Schumpeter?
Yeah, so Mr. Chairman.
We're definitely not polled about
and
this kind of issue, although we are given a lot of emails encouraging us to email you. And
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a follow-up question? Do you elect a board of directors that you empower to make these decisions for you?
Yeah.
You do. Okay, and so, you know, possible.
So essentially, I could run for the board.
Okay. Just wanted that clarified. Just you know, again, a lot of us receive emails, and
it's a huge organization.
It's 26,000 people, and so, Mr. Chairman, that makes us all think twice about this. But again, from other information I've gotten, it's not clear that there's a formal process for generating the positions of the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And so I was just curious about if people say that's the position of the organization, really, if in fact it is.
It's pretty removed. I mean, you may get representatives of the organization that would come up and say that there's been some discussion, but it's definitely not sent out to all realtors. Here is our position. You know, do you agree with that? But we are given, you know, on this particular issue, I was probably emailed about five times asking me to contact my legislator and support my own. And there's always links where you can go and learn more, but it's a couple paragraphs that's very, you're going to have to explain to your clients this increase, and it's not a very comprehensive explanation of the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Madore.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And testifiers, I'm hoping you can answer this question. During one of your testimony, the brokers, the real estate agents here, one of you mentioned that there was a 50% increase in fees to the home buyer or the home seller since 2001 to 2004. I'm wondering if you can clarify that. And could you please tell me what the legislative review is on those fees?
Ms. Williams.
If there is one.
Mr. Chair and members, what I spoke about was the selling prices of homes have gone up from the year 2000 to the year 2005 by 50%. Your equity in your home has gone up by 50%.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Wasn't there some fees that you had talked about that had also increased over the same time period?
Ms. Williams.
Yes. All the fees have gone up. I just said that the cost of selling a home goes up.
Representative McGraw.
Yeah,
I'm trying to get at, obviously we're being highly scrutinized here for considering a 1.7. 0.17. Sorry, Representative France. Increase here, and we've all gotten the letters with the emails that are the four or five paragraphs of warning us that this is going to absolutely decimate our ability to sell homes here in the state of Minnesota. But what I'm wondering is the issue here is that the fees continue to increase to sell a home.
Yeah.
Those are the things you're explaining to your clients, but who reviews the prices of those increases in fees? I haven't received a thing asking me if it's okay to raise a broker fee to $500. I'm not getting any kind of legislative review on who is not only generating these fees, but whether or not they're reasonable to pass them on to a home seller. So I'm just wondering. I know the Commerce Department is in charge of monitoring. Are they also in charge of monitoring the fees that are charged to people when they sell their homes?
Ms. Williams.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I don't know for a fact, but title companies raise their fees as they will. Mortgage companies raise their fees as they will. I don't know who scrutinizes those increases in fees.
Representative Madure.
And this is specific. So, again, your organization that's talking to us about this 0.17% increase has no problem with accepting title company fee increases, brokerage fee increases, other fee increases, sometimes even your commission increases, and yet they are against a tax that will help people move into homes, buy homes, and stay in their communities. I'm trying to understand your organization's position on this, and I'm sorry that you're both in the hot seat for it. And if there's somebody...
There's no chair.
Ms. Coleman.
Okay.
Or Ms. Williams.
Yeah, I think you've got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative
Severson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a plethora of questions here. One of them would be to the two realtors here. How has your real estate business been this last year?
Ms. Williams or Ms. Coleman?
The market has been down this year.
Mm-hmm. Representative Severson.
And how do you expect that process to proceed as we go forth here?
Ms. Williams. Mr. Chair. The market has a pretty normal historical pickup in the spring, and we are seeing that the buyers are out at open houses now. So, go ahead.
And I would say statistics that we've been given at work and that kind of thing is that the market looks healthier than it did a year ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just tell you, my wife is a real estate agent as well. And this year, last year, was pretty slim. And I think some of the things that need to be brought out here is that the commissions that Representative Madure was talking about, those are negotiable. The realtor's commissions are negotiable. There's no hard, fixed number that you have to go into in this thing, as are some of these fees negotiable when you want to go into it. Some realtors choose to slap on an administrative fee. And you, as a customer, as a consumer, can say, you know what, I don't want to pay that, or I want to negotiate that. And I think one of the things we've been talking about here is what is a good means of doing affordable housing in an industry that supports housing. And I'm hearing a lot of people say they're willing to throw up their hand and, you know, I'm willing to pay some of this stuff, but we're not talking about the people who are going into foreclosure. We're not talking about the people who are losing their equity in a downtime in a real estate market, who are forced to sell and move someplace else, and now we're basically picking their pocket. So there's some problems with this particular bill, and I'm anxious to hear the realtor's side on this as well. So I'll stop my comments there, Mr. Chair, and hopefully we can hear from the opposition.
Mr. Chair, to that point, the foreclosures are exempt from this. Just so you're aware. And also, in fact, the programs that exist would help bridge and hopefully eliminate foreclosures, because there'd be assistance there in this program in many of them.
Well, and Mr. Chair, to that point, it doesn't necessarily go to the point of foreclosure. A lot of people will jump out because they have to move someplace else or because they have to relocate for any other reason. We're basically saying, you know, you have to be beyond willing. We're just going to take this money from you in addition to. So I think there's a voice that needs to be heard on this particular side as well. And I didn't mean to chirp in so quickly, but I think we need to hear the other side of the argument as well. And I thank you for testifying.
Representative Severson. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really just want to make a comment, and I hope that it's relevant. I'll try. This has been a strange week in that we're talking about this bill tonight. I represent a little community called Landfall, which is a community of manufactured homes. A week ago, tonight, this community experienced a tragic fire where three members of a family were killed by the fire. On Sunday, I drove over to Landfall and I visited the site where the fire occurred and saw the devastation of that mobile home that was now just a steel shell with no roof, just a lot of debris. I became acquainted with a family who lived in that community about three homes away, and I just decided that I would stop by and see how they were doing. I knew they had little children, and I was concerned that the children would be upset. And my family invited me into this home, and it was probably 8 feet wide and maybe 20 feet long. Very, very old, probably 40 years old, which was about the same age as the home that burned. What I feel right now, and it's feelings, but there is an ethical and moral responsibility that we have as a community. And that ethical moral responsibility has to do with valuing the lives of everyone who lives in our community, even the poor. And I live in a very comfortable home. And when I drove home from Landfall that night, after having seen the devastation and visiting this family in their home, I realized how very blessed I am, how much I have, and that the small fraction that it would cost for me to give to this kind of a fund would not harm me at all, but would help others a great deal. That's my comment. I want you to know that I've struggled a great deal with this bill. I don't necessarily like the way the bill is worded. I struggle with some of the provisions in it. But I came here to this great opportunity to serve in the legislature in order to make a difference in people's lives. And I will stand by that commitment. If it gets me unelected, so be it. I am here because people in Minnesota deserve to live in quality homes and have a quality life, and I hope that we're able to make that happen.
Representative McCrimmon.
Yes, Madam Chair. I agree with Representative Swales, and I don't think there's anybody in this room that doesn't feel that we need to do that. It's just a matter of how we make the solution. I just wanted, at this point, want to ask or bring up one clarifying point. This is not only the sale of homes, it's also the sale of commercial property and agricultural property also, right? So I mean, I think it impacts more than just homeowners, and I think people should be aware of that. And we're talking many more dollars when we're talking about those pieces of property.
Representative Shumper.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a couple questions on existing DTAC, Representative Krantz, which is 0.33%. My understanding is that 0.3% goes into the general fund and 0.03 goes to county auditors. Is that correct? Or am I wrong?
That's correct. Currently, of the current 0.33% deed tax that exists, 0.3 of that is general fund dollars and 0.03 of that is administrative costs. So there is some administrative costs, but really 0.3% of the current deed tax goes into general fund dollars in the first place. Yeah, I could have gone after the 0.17 out of the 0.3, but once again, then you're creating a hole. I mean, that was everything was considered.
Madam Chair, one additional question. Madam Chair, Mr. Dahl, I think you mentioned before, perhaps it was in my office, that a number of other states have deed taxes, and are any of them more than our state deed tax?
Mr. Dahl.
Did you cover that?
Madam Chair, Representative Shumper, 37, I'm operating on some information that's just a little dated, but I believe that 35 to 37 other states have deed taxes. There are 10 states that dedicate the deed tax for housing or homelessness programs, and there are 17 other states that have higher deed taxes than Minnesota. If this proposal went into effect, we would be number 12. Other states have, there's one state that has a deed tax of 2%. There are plenty of states that have 0.5 to 0.75%. Our deed tax is relatively small for those that do have one.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions from committee members or these witnesses? If not, then we need to hear other people who would like to testify. Excuse me. I guess we had one more person to testify in favor of the bill. Is that right? Do one more, and then we'll go to the opposition. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Susan Fiedler. I just heard about the hearing today and rushed over. I speak for myself, but hopefully represent all the women who have exited successfully from a battered marriage. And the group that I have worked with most carefully is Domestic Abuse Project. However, because I am a disabled woman with spinal disease and a fusion and worked my way woman with spinal disease and a fusion and worked my way out of a wheelchair since 1996, I had to wait till I was stronger and more able-bodied from my last surgery in 2003 before I could find a shelter that would house me for up to 30 days because I didn't have children. I couldn't organize anything until July of 2004. I was given 30 days. I had no housing because my only income was Social Security disability. The waiting list for affordable housing at very unsafe high-rises and local places that are in desperate, horrible neighborhoods that I'd be so frightened to live in and might say, eat me for breakfast on the back of my head. There was nothing. So I had to return 4 times to my husband and be abused another 2 years before I obtained my divorce. I actually did live in my car for 2 months rather than take a cot on the Salvation Army floor. I was told by many organizations that I really didn't want to be free if I didn't take that cot. I couldn't take the cot because I still was very unsteady and really hadn't been out of the house for a long time. So why I'm here is to say please. I can't tell you how many people I called, organizations I called, to please help me. Please help me find a place to live so I could be free. I had a job. I work at the Guthrie
It gave me a beginning. I'm so proud to be amongst people that honored me, and I appreciate what you said, because I am poor. I need help, but I am a citizen. I've been in this state since 1979. I'm from the UP in Michigan. I love this state. I've done a lot of volunteer work before I was hurt, and I've done volunteer work since for the Domestic Abuse Project, helping other women get through the system. But I'm here purposely for myself. I made it. I made it with the help of the Domestic Abuse Project, and there needs to be more money. I chose to live in my car. I had a car. I was so lucky. But where else are other people going? I was afraid I would be killed. So that's the rules. There's a lot of places that will give you a shelter for 30 days. If you're able-bodied in the women's shelter, there needs to be a lot of work there, but that's another story. And I just think that people who have homes and dinner on the table, they don't... I owned my own house. I owned my own house in the late 80s in Duluth. But I sold it to come down here with my husband so he could find a better job. Now those little funds are gone. There's no way that I'll probably ever be able to own a house again because I'm not able to work, you know, enough to save up a lot of money. And now that I'm over 50, that might be a mortgage problem. But please, I support this act. It doesn't seem like so much money, and it could really make a difference to people like myself and others that are besides me. So I thank you for listening to me.
Okay, it's time to hear from
you. Before you hear the opposition, could we just ask people in the audience that are here and taking time out of their family?
Why don't you come up to the microphone, please? And I think you want to make a request. That's fine.
Madam Chair, Sue Watwell Phillips, I'm Executive Director of Elam Transitional Housing with the Minnesota National Coalition for the Homeless and Board Member of MICA. Obviously, we have a number of people here that have taken a significant amount of time out of their family life and time this evening to be here to show their support for this particular bill. And I'd just like one moment for those folks to stand before you hear the opposition. Thank you.
So anybody that's in support of the Housing Solutions Act, you can stand, please. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. Okay. Next, we would like to hear from the opposition. Welcome to the committee, and if you'll introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Susan DiOri, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And I do come to speak respectfully in opposition to this legislation for a multitude of reasons. The first issue I'd like to bring forth is the issue of the purview of this committee, I believe, is to try to establish what we mean by affordable housing. This bill has a very wide range. A good portion of the testimony that you've heard before you does talk about the homeless, battered women, and things of that nature. But this piece of legislation before you actually does go all the way up to 115% of median family income, which is, for a family of four, about $85,000. So I guess I would encourage the committee, when we talk about affordable housing issues, to try to get some sense of what the definition of affordable housing is. Another point I'd like to make is that the particular tax that is before you, it's the proposal that is before you. Some of the proponents stated that everyone should help for homeless initiatives. And I would argue that that is what the Minnesota Association of Realtors supports, that everyone in our society should be helping to help those who cannot help themselves. So why are we looking at a regressive tax? This legislature has spent a great deal of time in this session talking about property taxes, and this is a tax on property. This is a regressive tax, and a regressive tax means it's going to hurt the people we say we're trying to help, particularly on housing, because on a deed tax, for example, lower-valued homes are going to turn over more frequently than our higher-valued homes. So we're going to pay more times on a detax than we are on hired value homes. It was also pointed out already that this does not apply just to single-family residential property. This applies to all properties. And so from a rental perspective, we've had some of our commercial realtors call us and say, if you sell a residential multi-unit apartment complex, this is a substantial tax on a commercial property, which means we're going to divide that into the apartment units most likely to cover their costs of this particular tax. Our association clearly does oppose this legislation for those reasons. We do believe that this legislature should prioritize, and if this is a priority for this legislature, we do believe that this legislature should look within the $53 billion that it is going to be spending in the upcoming biennium and spend within that $53 billion and not raise additional taxes, particularly regressive taxes. And if this legislature does decide to raise taxes, let's raise a progressive tax. Why aren't we talking about a progressive tax so that those people who can afford to pay it will pay it? So from our members' perspective, I just want to point out for the one point, there was a lot of testimony against the realtors in general prior to this due to the questions. And I will, of course, say that our realtor members, there is nothing in the state statute that says somebody has to use a real estate agent, whether they're a member of our association or not. You don't have a choice as a seller or a buyer to pay for a tax. So you can choose not to use a real estate agent if you want to buy or sell a house. You don't have a choice if you're paying a tax. So in defense of our realtor members who are struggling themselves, on average they make $40,000 a year and who pay their own Social Security tax, both sides of Social Security. If they want health care insurance, they pay for it themselves. If they want to save for retirement, they save for it themselves. So you don't have to use a realtor if you're going to transact a house, but you do have to pay this tax. And to the degree that we've talked about a $400 increase, I hope that this committee also doesn't forget about the other $900 that's already there. So this is not just a $400 tax. This is going to be a $1,400 tax on one side for one average property in the state of Minnesota. So thank you. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you, Ms. Jerry. I wanted to ask questions. I actually have one myself.
Sure.
I really listened with interest to your recommendation that we consider a progressive tax instead. I'm wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit more on what progressive tax the realtors would support.
Again, Madam Chair, our association has taken a position that $53 billion is enough for the state of Minnesota, for the 5 million residents in the state of Minnesota. So our position is that we think you should stay within what the current economy is generating from a tax increase perspective. So we don't support any tax increases at this point because we, again, think $53 billion is enough for the 5 million people.
Okay, I just want to understand your comments, though. I think I heard you said that you would prefer a progressive tax if there were a tax increase. Can you elaborate on what that would be?
Right. I elaborated by saying if you want to do something, do an income tax. It's a progressive tax. If the legislature feels they need to raise taxes.
Thank you very much for that information. Anybody else have a question? You. Representative Lane.
I would just have a comment. You say in terms of we've taken the position, and I think we had some understanding that there may be a number of the people who sit on the Minnesota Realtors Association who may have these views. But I think it was said that there was no poll of your members to come to a consensus around this. So I would say the we is limited as opposed to and you certainly carry that opinion, and you certainly have the right to that opinion. But I would not say that it necessarily is the view of 26,000 realtors. And on the other hand, to just keep rolling here, it may well be the position of realtors to not want this tax on other people. So you're not really speaking of a tax on you, but you're willing to take an income tax on you, which is very interesting. But I would suggest that the people who would be taxed are the homeowners, and that we have heard from them, and we are represented by them, and that those are the ones who would say, and that stack in front of you probably represents homeowners, and that those are the people that are really being impacted.
Madam Chair, if I may respond. Thank you. I would say that some of the testifiers were a little misinformed on how our association operates. We have an open governmental affairs committee. Any member, any of the 26,000 members of our association is free to serve on our committee. And we do pull from time to time issues about the legislative process and what's important to our realtor members. So these testifiers have the absolute right to come and serve on our governmental affairs committee. We do have a democratic process. That governmental affairs committee does take positions on behalf of our association. So we do have a formal process, and we put it forth, we bring it forth. And of course, I don't think we ever claimed that all 26,000 of our members, just like all of your constituents, aren't going to agree with you on every issue. Not all 26,000 members of our association are going to agree with us, the positions of the formal positions of the association either.
Madam Chair, did you take a poll for this particular issue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, we have not taken a poll, well, specifically on the deed tax, but taxes in general.
On the deed tax specifically?
Not specifically on the deed tax, but taxes in general.
And then I would just comment that as a member of the, in the past of the Minnesota School Board, as an example of how the entire state comes down to a consensus opinion from school boards to the legislative delegation, it is a process where things are chosen or talked about at each school board level. The representative is sent then to a delegation, and on down they go to the finally when they have the conference where they actually decide the legislative processes for that particular time. It's very, very clearly a representation of the entire state. There are ways to do this if you're going to actually represent your people.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions here. First of all, agricultural land, you talked about that being something that you were concerned about, the sale price for that. When people sell agricultural land, who do they usually sell it to? What would you say?
Madam Chair and Representative, I didn't speak to agricultural land. I said this is going to apply to all property. I think one of the other testifiers talked about agricultural land.
So, Madam Chair, my question for that is, in my community, agricultural land is being sold to multi-million-dollar investment firms to develop housing. So I have a little problem here with us saying that agricultural land, again, is going to devastate our ability to sell homes here in Minnesota. The other thing that was referenced was commercial property. And I'm asking, does that property usually sell at an increase in value?
Ms. Jerry? Madam Chair, property values historically, in general, have never declined except for the Great Depression. So all property values, yes, have increased over time. It's certainly a matter from year to year on the percentage increase, but all property values generally appreciate in value, with the exceptions of certain areas when there's job loss or things of that nature.
So, Madam Chair, again, just on this philosophy here, because I really do want to understand this and your position as an organization.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a small business that has bought some land, developed some commercial property. They outgrow that business because they've been in a community where they've had good quality schools where kids are able to come in and right out of high school perhaps and work in that or go to a community college and come to that business and work. They've been able to get local customers to come in and be a part of that business. They may have had good quality roads and transportation so that that business could develop. They may have had a lot of good reasons to start out in that community, but now they've determined that they need to move on and move up because they've been blessed by being part of a community that's embraced them and supported their business opportunity. And you're telling me now that just a small tax on that property to give back to the community is going to be enough to stop all business development and home selling in the state of Minnesota.
Because that's what your emails say to me, ma'am. I'm telling you what I've read on the 7-paragraph emails that I've gotten from over 100 of your members.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and Representative Mazur, I don't think we said it's going to totally devastate the entire industry. Certainly it's going to have an impact at a time where the testifiers before us have clearly talked about our brochure that we put together for the legislature to consider these issues, the significant issues that are facing this legislature in the near future from a tax and spending perspective. We clearly said it's going to impact the market at a time when the market's already down. I don't think we ever said it was going to completely wipe out the industry, or maybe some of your constituents might have added some paragraphs to the bottom, but we clearly have said it's of concern to our realtor members. And I would also add that a number of these letters that you're receiving are from sellers and buyers.
Madam Chair, that is not true. What I'm hearing from sellers is we've seen a profit by living in this community, by having good schools, good roads, quality, good public safety. We've seen an increase in value here that we could have never gotten at a certificate of deposit of a bank or some other wealth building tool that we have. And I'm grateful for my community for giving me this opportunity to build my own personal wealth. And if it means another $100 at the end of the day when I'm paying hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to sell my house, I'm grateful to the community with which I've been able to see this profit. So I strongly disagree with you on your assumption that sellers are upset about this. I have not heard from a single seller, but I've had my email box full of letters from your group telling me that this is going to totally decimate the ability for you to make a living in the state of Minnesota.
I don't know if you care to respond or to move on to the next question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have anything further to add to that.
Representative Shumper?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Iori, I just want to follow up briefly on the discussion you and I had in my office about the policy committee for your organization. I believe you said this last January, 63 people showed up for discussion. That was the number I wrote down in my notes from our meeting.
Mr. Iori?
Madam Chair and Representative, I believe that's that number is approximately the number who choose to serve on our committee, yes.
Okay, and after they made some decisions about policies for your group, what did they do with those? Did they send them on to another body, like your board of directors, for approval, or did they make a recommendation to some other governing body for your organization, or what? What happened after that?
Sherry?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, our board of directors is certainly updated on the positions of the association, but our government affairs committee, their decision stands. So, again, our government affairs committee, anybody can serve on it. In fact, some of the proponents of this legislation have been asked numerous times to come and serve on it, and they've chosen not to come and serve on our particular government affairs committee. Our board of directors knows about it, but our government affairs committee is the decision maker for the positions of our association.
And just briefly, you have 26,000 members in your group?
Approximately, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First I want to make a statement. I felt very passionate about an issue about a week ago. It was in the higher education stem cell. And I was trying to make a particular point, and I was afraid I was getting too antagonistic towards the witness, but after seeing Representative Shumper and Medora here, I think I was a nice guy. I do have an amendment, Madam Chair, and I know this is a little late. But I'm hoping that we'll have an opportunity to discuss this, I think particularly because as this deed tax has been instituted since 1987 and may have not seen a rise in the particular percentages, we're still seeing a percentage in the rise of monies that are coming through that deed tax to the general fund. And that's the key issue here, is that and should that be going to the general fund, or would it be more appropriate going to a more appropriate cause such as affordable housing? And so what this amendment merely does is it says one half of that deed tax, the 0.3 that is going to the general fund now,
would be dedicated to affordable housing, or 0.17. And that would create a hole in the general fund of about $56 million. But I think if we're going to be honest about the importance of affordable housing, and I apologize, I didn't mean to cut you off, ma'am, that this is a worthy cause. This is a cause I think that we all believe in. I know, especially those who are here. And I think one of the issues is, do we as a state have a responsibility to try and meet some of these needs? I think absolutely. But I think also, we can do it within the existing tax structure that would be more appropriate, which would be a reapportionment of this deed tax. And Madam Chair, I'm hoping that you'll at least consider this amendment.
Okay. Just a couple things. There were a couple more people on the list who wanted to ask questions, and I'm of the witness who was here, and I want to at least honor that. And we'll come back to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We can talk a little bit about the process for that too, but I just want to make sure we can honor those folks who are waiting in line. Representative Eastland and McFarland, I have. Is that Eastland? Did you have a question?
I just had a couple of comments, Madam Chair. I appreciate the passionate conversation and the questioning that I think that's here. But I think I want to go back to something I think Representative Swale said, and I think Representative Krantz said it in his opening comments as well, that we're here to make tough decisions. And that's part of what we're elected here to do. And we have needs everywhere. I don't know, Mr. Representative Krantz, you said on this committee you see needs. I mean, I serve on corrections. There's horrendous needs on corrections. I serve in early childhood. There's horrendous needs in early childhood. I believe you're on there, too. I mean, the reality is we cannot fund every need of every group in the state of Minnesota. I mean, that's the reality. So we have to make tough choices. And I think one of the places that we start making tough choices is to say, if we have $2.5 billion more to spend this year than we had 2 years ago, maybe we should make some tough choices and decide that we're going to live inside of that. Now, if we can fund this, and we want to make those tough choices and prioritize this over something else, that's what that's the tough choice we should be making. And I think that's what the amendment that Representative Stevenson is bringing to the table is all about. It's easy in a vacuum to say, well, this is just a little increase, but then we could go to early childhood, and that's a little increase, and we could go to corrections, and that's a little increase, and we could go to the judicial system, and that's a little increase, and we could go. There's little increases all over the place, but the overriding message that I heard in my election, and the overriding message I heard in the questionnaires that I sent out is, please don't raise our taxes. $2.5 billion is enough. That's what I'm hearing from my constituents that I represent. I hear this group here today. They have a need. We have $2.5 billion to address this need. Let's do it that way. Let's make the tough decisions that we were elected to do. And I think I just want to speak in support of Representative Severson's amendment. I think if this is a priority, then let's make it a priority. Let's pass this bill out of here, and let's designate the funds that are going to fund this program out of current revenues, and let's make the tough decisions to live within our $2.5 billion increase. I mean, that's the way I see this issue, Mr. Representative Krantz.
Did you have a question for the witness? Otherwise, you're talking to the amendment that's not on the table before you. And I was just—you had your hand up when the witness was there. I guess maybe that you didn't have a question for her then.
I had a comment about all of the conversation that's been going on here, and I just wanted to speak and say, the point here is not that some people support this and some people don't support this because they support or don't support this bill. That is the wrong conclusion to come to from here. I think everybody supports the initiative. We're on this committee, and this is one of the issues that we all think is very important to address. And there's ways to address it that keep us inside of, I think, the parameters that we were elected to be, in my opinion, at least what my constituents are telling me, we were elected to do, which was live within the means that we've given you and address the needs that are the most important and pressing to the state.
Thank you, Representative Eastland. Do you have a response to his comment?
I do have a response to that comment.
Please, please.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, there's been a lot of discussion about the realtors and our decisions and how we've come to them, and et cetera, et cetera, and support for homeless initiatives and things of that nature. It's interesting that we don't get the same questions when our association has come forth a number of years ago to support dedicated funding from our real estate interest trust accounts to go to the MHFA. And we don't get the same kinds of questions when our Realtor Association takes a position to support legal aid dedicated funding for legal aid. So it is a bit frustrating. The realtors are not opposed to the government helping those who are in need. That's not our position. It's a matter of how you, first of all, what you call affordable housing, and second of all, how you fund that.
Okay. Representative McFarland, was your question to the witness?
Not really. At this point, hoping we can move on. I've got 3 other meetings yet to attend tonight, and I'm just trying to
follow the process of we got a witness before us. And I think the last person then, Representative Medora, is it to this witness?
It is, actually. I'm very excited about this. What exactly is that proposal, and how quickly can we get an amendment to this bill to fund that?
It's in existence.
It's in existence right now.
It has been for many years.
And what is the...
Yes, over the chair.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry, Madam Chair.
Everybody's getting excited. That's all right.
I am a little bit, because anytime we can look for revenue, I'm excited. So what exactly is that funding right now, and what is the dollar amount on that, and when did you have this position open? And I think, Madam Chair, between this testifier and myself, maybe we can come up with the $53 million we're looking for here. So,
Jerry, Madam Chair, then we're going to let you go.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's been in existence for decades. We were one of the first in the nation to adopt such a proposal, and our association was a proponent of it. That all of the interest, when somebody transacts business and they put earnest money down payment, the statutes require our brokers to put that in an interest-bearing trust account. All of the interest from that trust account goes towards the MHFA, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, to be utilized towards the programs that these testifiers have spoken in favor of. So it's been in existence for many, many, many years. The dollar amounts, I wish I knew, because we've asked from time to time and I've never been able to actually find out that number. But we feel that we've done our part as realtor members. We have supported these initiatives. And, from the standpoint of attacking one industry because we oppose the method of supporting this, it's a bit frustrating, because I don't see anybody here proposing a tax on teachers or a tax on farmers or a tax on just buyers and sellers. And it's a bit frustrating.
Okay. I think this witness...
Sorry, Madam Chair, to that point. Actually, I do have... Would the testifier sitting next to me be surprised if it was less than $1 million annually?
I wish I knew.
Okay. I've been briefed that we have data that it's less than $1 million. But just to put things in perspective, it's wonderful. We appreciate their support. But
sure, $1 million can help a lot.
Madam
okay.
Chair,
is it for this witness?
Otherwise, are we on the amendment?
Not yet. Chair? We're trying to get there.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, members, we do have an amendment that came to us late hour today. I'm going to honor it, and we're going to have a chance to discuss it. I do want to tell committee members, it's a little better than the last one that came right on the desk right as we sat down, but we only got a couple of hours before. And I really want to advise you, please get the amendments. This notice on this committee hearing was out last week, and I'm going to be a little tougher as time gets shorter. We have enough time today. We'll go ahead and do this amendment, but I really ask for your perspective to the process that we amended earlier. As we do have a 24-hour rule that we're a little bit flexible on. Okay, so Representative Stevenson, you have this amendment before you. We're going to discuss it. Do you want to move the amendment?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move the H0939A1 amendment.
Does the author have that?
Representative
Kranz.
Actually, I would like to not offer any amendments at this time.
Okay.
Speaking to his amendment. If I know that we're going to, my original motion for this bill was to roll it into an omnibus bill. I will tell you that I can renew that motion again. And Representative Severson, I looked into that very same thing that you are talking about bringing your amendment forward, and I will continue to look into that. Maybe we can, if there's time and you want to go through that today, Madam Chair, that's fine. But we can certainly discuss those things as the omnibus bill is put together, and we can address it at that point. I'm sure we're going to address it later, either way. So if we want to discuss it now or later, I don't care.
I know I have some committee members who need to go on to other committees. I would like to provide maybe about 10 minutes max for this amendment. Is that all right with members? And that means no one person should dominate a whole lot in the discussion. I think Representative Krantz, you gave your initial impression of that. Anybody else want to speak to the amendment?
Madam Chair, if I could speak just real quickly. Again, thank you for the flexibility, and I would just like to ask for a roll call on this amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay, roll call requested on the amendment. Representative Schumper.
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I have to say I'm inclined to vote for this amendment, and I actually have thought about the same amendment myself. I guess I'd like to know if you're going to vote for your own amendment, because occasionally on one of our other committees, Representative Emmer likes to make motions and votes against them. And quite often he likes to do that. And then secondly, if this ever gets to the floor, would you vote for this, using this deed tax for housing? I guess that's what I'd like to ask you.
Yeah, and that, Representative Shepard, that's a fair question, and I would. Because I believe if we are going to commit funds, this is a particular, it's like a gas tax. It's a user fee. It's one of those things that, you know, makes logical sense that it would come out of a deed tax. If this is indeed where we're going to generate funds for, this would be the place that I would prefer to have it come out. So, yes, I would.
Thank you.
Now, that is, Representative Shepard, that's provided that this was the only issue that was on the bill. There are many other things that get attached to these things that I can't vote for, but I'll tell you, in this principle, I believe it. And Madam Chair and Representative Shepard, to be honest, I typically don't do things I don't believe in. So, and I believe in affordable housing, just as I believe everybody that's on this committee believes in affordable housing. I believe that we have an obligation to take care of the poor and needy, but there are constraints that we have to operate within as policymakers, and one of those is also to be a steward of the tax dollars that we are elected to oversee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, to the maker of the amendment, and again, just clarification, you're saying we would not do the increase, we would submit to take the existing collection of deed tax and commit it to housing as they're suggesting.
Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
And Representative Peterson, that's correct. It would be 0.17. The current deed tax is 0.33. This would be 0.17. 0.3 would go to administration, and the remainder would go to the general fund.
Madam Chair, the reason I think it's important for the audience, and I know that the presenter of the bill knows this, when you're trying to move something this monumental, this far, and with this much money, you have to figure out what are your odds of getting it done. And the dilemma we have with this bill right now is you're one thing to ask for the commitment of those monies that have been collected to go to housing. That is proper. We went through that whole thing a year ago with gasoline license plates that money was eaten up that never was dedicated to transportation like we, and that was the constitutional limit. We have the same thing going on here. The dilemma with the bill right now is you're also asking for an increase, which is going to require a tax increase, plus you're pulling the money out. And this thing is walking right into a veto. And I would just suggest seriously that you really ought to look at eating an elephant one bite at a time. Getting the commitment to dedicate these monies to housing is a monumental step. I would suggest you listen to the amendment, take that one step, get on with it, let's get some housing built. Because the second step is much, much more difficult, and it could deep six the whole thing.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry that I'm running back and forth. I'm on three committees simultaneously. And so I would just like to have a little clarification about this amendment. What are the numbers here that at least approximation are we talking about as compared to the original bill and the effect of this particular amendment?
Maybe the maker of the amendment, Representative Stevenson, can you answer that question?
Madam Chair, I'll defer to counsel on that. Did you not have any?
Just sure to make up the numbers.
Have you had a chance to look at the amendment?
I have looked at them, but I don't know the not dollars involved.
Okay.
And we can, and Madam Chair and members, we can certainly get that information as soon as possible, but this is the first time I've seen the amendment as well.
I mean, this is the problem with getting amendments to us very late. This amendment fails. It's partly it's going to be because we don't have good information here, and that we need. We should try to honor the 24-hour rules not only for all the members but for our staff. Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. With the discussion that Representative Peterson just gave, and the fact that we haven't any idea from the author of this amendment what the fiscal impact would be, it leaves me in an extreme quandary as to how to proceed. So maybe there's advice from some wise person here who can instruct me as to what I ought to do.
Representative Benson, I might try to take that challenge on a little bit. I thought I heard Representative Kranz indicate that he's willing to work with not only the author of this amendment, but any other amendments that might come forward. Because this, we are holding this in our committee. That's the motion. And I'm just thinking, Representative Severson, if you might be willing to withdraw your amendment for now, work with Representative Kranz, get the numbers so that people know what in the world they're voting on, and maybe we can go forward. We are going to have this back before you. There's no way it's going to be rushed through. It's part of the whole omnibus bill. And then it may need to go to another committee, but we got it first.
Okay.
So I guess I'd ask you to consider that, and if you would,
Madam Chair, members, I could quickly say, I mean, in the revenue or in the fiscal note, it does say that the current D tax is projected to generate about $208 million in the biennium. So I guess you could, you know, do quick math and say half of that would go towards to the housing if you wanted to do 0.17%.
Okay, Representative Moore, did you have a comment?
Speaking, Madam Chair, specific to the amendment, Representative Peterson brings up the challenge for us. I mean, obviously, we've heard a lot of compelling testimony tonight and in this committee that we have dramatic housing needs in the state of Minnesota. I don't think anybody here disagrees with that, and our challenge is to try to find the resources to do that. I wondered, you know, Ms. Daria, Realtors Association of Realtors, said that she would support, or maybe not support, but would prefer a more progressive tax. And as a caucus and as House representatives, we are going to consider that and try to come up with revenue sources that perhaps we can all agree on. If we proceed with that and yet decide to dedicate a portion of the existing deed tax, can we count on outside support from the opposition for additional revenue enhancements or income tax increase or something else to fill the hole that we're creating with this amendment? I mean, I think Representative Peterson again makes a very compelling point. We have the governor to deal with, but we also need to raise revenue. So, you know, if we adjust the funding source, I'm not saying we do that here. Maybe we do, I don't know. But are you going to help us out then? So we keep the deed tax the way it is and perhaps work with you to find additional revenue to fill the hole that we create. Steering.
Madam Chair, Representative, I actually responded to this point when the Chair asked the question. Our association has taken a position that $53 billion that's going to be spent in the next biennium is sufficient. And the economy has generated a surplus, and so you have that to spend on top. So from our position, we do not support tax increases. All we have said is that if this legislature decides that they need to raise a tax, we would prefer you to raise a progressive tax, not a regressive tax.
So you like this?
Representative Mulk.
You would dislike this less. Madam Chair.
Sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Mo, that would be correct.
Thank you.
All right, I have a couple more people who wish to speak. Representative Morgan?
Madam Chair, you made the point already, and that's what I was going to suggest. If perhaps the author of the amendment and the author of the bill could sit down, this is just going to be laid over for consideration, possibly to be included in the omnibus bill, and maybe we ought to cross that bridge when we come to it, would be my suggestion.
Madam Chair.
I have Representative Peterson. Yeah. Representative...
And I would
Madam
Chair, I have a document in front of me that suggests that the tax currently raises about $121 million a year. So if the way the motion is, about three-quarters of that would be available for housing. This is $75 or $80 million. It's a very significant sum of money. So if the author is willing to negotiate that, I was hoping that this crowd is here supporting housing will give him some support and courage, again, to take the elephant one bite at a time. And I'll shut up now and not talk beyond the sales.
Madam Chair, to that point, I respect the wisdom of Representative Peterson a great deal. You'll notice that originally this was on a different track. Hopefully I'm sure all of you caught my motion. We are working through this. This elephant didn't just appear today, to use your analogy, and I'm sure you know that. In fact, I think we have experienced elephant eaters that are working on this that actually know where to take the right bites from. All I'm doing is being here willing to take another bite out of that elephant, and as we try to move this forward, that's, I think, precisely what we're trying to do. And I think I've shown a good faith in trying to find a solution that works for both sides and is fiscally responsible. So, I mean, we're not done eating yet, but we're looking forward to a few more chews.
Representative Medora, Shumpert and Lane.
For once, I'm going to pass.
Representative Shumpert.
Madam Chair, a quick question. If we pass Representative Stevenson's amendment, do we have to send it to the Tax Committee or something?
The motion before us is to have it reside in this committee, and we can do that as long as we choose.
So even if we fiddle with the tax thing, we don't have to send it to the tax committee. Okay? Just wanted to clarify.
At this point in time, the motion that we have before us is to have it reside in this committee. Representative Lane.
Okay, I may not be accurate in the details, but I'm seeing this as six of this, half dozen of the other. So that we could take money that's in the general fund and take half of it and use it to this and leave a hole which would then have to come from somewhere, maybe the money that's already going to homeless. And we'd be in the same place we are now. Or we could take the money that's going to homeless and housing now and put forth the possibility of something more and maybe have it vetoed, and we'd be where we are now. Six of this, half dozen of the other. That's my comment.
Representative Lane, you're such a good teacher. I'd like to come back to the author of the bill. And what is your wish? Back to the author of the amendment. What is your wish, Representative Stevenson, with the amendment? Then we'll go back to the author.
I'm kind of hiding, Madam Chair, so you don't get to see me always. I apologize. Your staff can't see me well. You know, Madam Chair, I believe this is important that we do vote on this. I think these folks have all come here to want us to vote on it. And the proposal is to increase the taxes, and some folks that truthfully can't afford a tax increase. Or we need to make the hard decisions and take this out of the $2.8 billion that we have in new revenue available us in the coming biennium and use it for a program as important as this. So Representative Severson's amendment is to decide whether we want to have a tax increase or do we want to not have a tax increase. And if we want to do this bill, then we make the hard decisions to include it. I would say, Madam Chair, that if we don't pass Representative Severson's amendment,
I Representative Kranz would have to go to the tax committee because this is a new tax increase the way your bill is presented, and it's important for the tax committee and Chair Lincheski to get a chance to look at this hundred and some, is it not $107 million tax increase, and it's a regressive one at that. So, Madam Chair, it's Representative Severson's amendment. I will honor whatever he wants to do with the amendment. You've been gracious enough to allow it to move forward. But I think these folks want to know, are we going to vote to have a tax increase of $100+ million now and know that it's going to be used for housing? Or do they expect the people on this committee to be part to make the hard decisions and include things like this that have been a priority of the governor's, maybe not to the amount of money this is, but we can talk about that. $2.8 billion, folks, ought to be enough. That's 9.8%. And I got to ask you all in the audience, our wages are not going up 9.8%. Why should the state of Minnesota go up above and beyond that? And Madam Chair, I just think we need to start making the decision. We can lay it over and delay it and finagle all we want, but at some point it's going to be too late at night and it's going to be too late close to deadline to not start to make these decisions.
Okay. Thank you. We're actually over the 10 minutes, but I've got Representative Benson, Morgan, Schumper. And I actually want the author of the bill to give us his leadership here on this. Representative Benson,
Thank you, ma'am.
Hope you're going to respond to
it. It'll be very, very short. Up on my desk somewhere, on those piles and piles of materials we get, it says that we have $2.2 billion. A billion of it is one-time money. At the State of the State address, the governor said we had $3 billion. Now we hear that our respected representative at the end of the table says we have $2.8 billion. Now, if we really have $2.8 billion instead of $2.2 billion, our problem is solved. I'm prepared to vote. I'm prepared to vote $400 million for affordable housing. It will not raise 1 cent in taxes. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have $200 million left over, according to the governor. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm not going to follow that.
Shumper, do you dare?
Yes, I do. My thoughts are similar to Representative Benson's, and I'm just sitting here. I don't think I'm going to be able to vote for Representative Severson's motion, because if we were to table it, and for a month, that $2.8 billion might be $5 or $6 billion. It's growing as we debate here. So,
Representative
Medora. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just echoing this, and I'd like to know when we moved up to $53 billion of available spending. So if that number is true, I'd like to have some documentation to support that. So thank you.
Interesting comments. Representative Kranz, your final advice to with the Representative Severson has the motion on the table. You can advise him, us, and
I've already, I think, made my statements pretty clear. I mean, if the author of this amendment would like to pull it down, we can work on it in the omnibus as we go through that process. I'm willing to do that. If he wants to push this issue, you know, I guess I want to hear from him, and then I'll decide what I'd
okay.
like to do.
Representative Severson.
Now fully informed. You know, I think we do. We have a clash of cultures here. We have those who want to raise taxes and those who don't. And my reservation, I'll be quite honest, my reservation for possibly pulling it was because I wasn't sure exactly what it said, because I saw the quarter and the quarter, and I thought it might have been miswritten, but I've gotten confirmation from council. No, it is exactly as we had wanted, which is that half of that goes to the general fund, half goes into affordable housing. And it does exactly what I think it should do, which is take those monies that are paid into the real estate business through the deed tax, dedicates them to affordable housing. So I will stand with the amendment.
Then I guess I need to know on parliamentary procedure what my options are.
You get to vote just like the rest of the committee members.
Fine. I just wanted to be clear on where I'm going with this. That's fine.
You're fine. I'm just asking your advice on, I think it's important probably to members of this committee, what the author of the bill
differs in terms of this amendment. So
you know, it was one of the considerations, and I've already spoken to this. I feel like I'm repeating myself.
Well, you know what? I think why don't you do it again anyway, because I think a couple of members are not in the room. So.
I mean, it certainly the need is great. The problem that I see with this is that we are going to have overlap. It's inevitable. But I also, in my own belief, I do believe that, government not only should be spending the tax dollar wisely, as it is not really our dollar, it's those who entrusted us to make wise decisions and make investments for the future. You know, if that's the only recourse we have, and that seems to be the way we're at, I have no problem voting on this amendment then.
Shumper and Mo.
Madam Chair, I think within our caucus we have some issues to discuss on this amendment. I would ask that we either have a brief recess or lay the bill on the table.
Is that a request for a brief recess, and the chair is inclined to give it? We're going to be back here in 10 minutes. Here we can go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your time, too. It became apparent to our caucus we lacked some fiscal information about the amendment, and we needed to talk about it a little bit more. We still have some questions, and so given that, defer to the author what to do with the bill and the amendment.
Yeah, I think because of that, Madam Chair. I would like to make a motion to just lay this on the table for now, and with the intent of trying to work through this process.
That is a non-debatable motion. The motion is before us to lay this bill on the table. House File 9. Any discussion? No discussion. Non-debatable. Correct myself. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
No. The vote is now on the table. Members, I think that concludes our... we have to...
Madam Chair.
This morning, as corrected, yes, have been corrected by... the correction to the minutes, the typo on the minutes of... March 13th,
I would move the approval of minutes this morning for March 13th.
Okay, hello, 10 a.m. There's an A after 10:05 a.m. Okay, the minutes are before us. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Is there any other business to come before us? This meeting is adjourned.